Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heart Strings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is obviously a wonderful and also amazing Friday. So our Friday, what we are going to do this Friday is we are going to listen to a lecture. I know, you're like, yeah, I like that, I like that. Yes, we're going to listen to a lecture, ne? And we are rounding off our conversation around relationship trauma, and this is the conclusion before the conclusion, okay? So this is the conclusion before the conclusion. Relationship trauma is the psychological distress caused by harmful experiences within an intimate relationship, such as emotional, physical, sexual abuse, infidelity, betrayal, or neglect. Now, we have touched base on betrayal on so many levels. Like, yo, I think our whole conversation was strictly just about betrayal, because yesterday we said causes and types, right? There is abuse, and then we just stuck there at betrayal. We stuck there at betrayal. And I think today we're going to continue with toxicity. We're going to continue with neglect, and we're going to talk about also how our childhood experiences, right, they have an impact on how we interact with one another in relationships. But tonight we're going to start off our conversation with a lecture, and I want you to take as much as humanly possible from this. And it's not just relationship trauma, right? It is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, trauma and CPTSD, and it's all of those trauma things, né, that we are going to be putting up into one conversation, and we're going to hear it. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let us listen to our lecture of the evening. And this is going to be from MediCircle. And it's going to be wild. Also, we as Eagle FM do not claim any ownership of any material or content that we are playing from our external factors. We are strictly just using them for illustration purposes, for sound purposes, for a message to be spread out purposes. And we are just, we are just sharing information. We are not saying that, oh yeah, us, it's Eagle Media House, this is our thing. Never. It's not our thing. Our thing is Matriarch. Matriarch is our thing. Matriarch is our thing. It's our thing to tang, tang, tang. Love it when you, love it when you go down, round to sand, 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 sand. Ow. Ow. Bow, ee, bow. All right, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy.
They're coming in, Dr. Christina. I see them now.
All right.
This is one of the few live free events that MedCircle provides, and I'm so glad that you're able to join us. For those of you joining live, for those of you joining in the replay, you can access the links below this video for many of the resources and future classes and series that we discuss during this broadcast. If you are watching this on YouTube and you've not subscribed to our YouTube channel, please do so. We post new videos every week on mental health topics that matter to you, featuring specialists and doctors just like Dr. Christina Iglesia, who joins us for her second time on MedCircle. Dr. Christina, thank you for being here. And I know people are still going to be slowly rolling in as we approach the start of this. But as people come in, why don't you provide a introduction of who you are?
Perfect. So as Kyle said, my name is Dr. Christina Iglesia. I work out of the San Francisco Bay Area.
In chat, but questions will only be taken from the Q&A box.
Hey guys, I'm Heidi Preeb. Welcome back to my channel, or welcome if you're new here. Today on this channel, we're talking about the concept of emotional neglect. And this is a topic that I personally feel very passionately about bringing into the conversations that we have around attachment healing, around trauma healing, around essentially any form of early developmental wounding. And the reason why I think it's so important to highlight this topic is because it's one that very frequently gets missed. So I think it's very common for people to start watching videos or reading content or in any way exposing themselves to information about trauma or attachment styles or whatever it is and go, yeah, I see myself in the symptoms of these things, but There's nothing I can point to in my childhood that was overtly traumatic. There's nothing that happened to me that I can really look at and go, yeah, that's the reason why I have all of these challenges. Very often when we talk about these topics, we're looking quite directly at what did happen in our childhoods. But we also have to pay attention to what didn't happen when we were young in order to make sense of how our cognition and our emotional world developed as adults. So when we look at things like depression and anxiety, PTSD, CPTSD, addiction, insecure attachment, emotional regulation problems, essentially all of these really big topics that get covered in psychology, we can see links to emotional neglect to all of them, which is not to say that all of these things are always caused by emotional neglect, but that at least a subset of all of these issues can and has reliably, through research, been linked to emotional neglect. So emotional neglect can be at the core of all of the above. However, realizing that you've been emotionally neglected is a very challenging thing to do. So what we're going to go over in this video is what actually happens when we experience early emotional neglect, how that shapes or fails to shape our emotional world in a way that can lead to a lot of challenges later in life. So essentially, the core of what we're looking at here is how emotional neglect leads to a disconnect between our subjective world, so our inner world of thoughts and feelings, and the outer, more objective world, so the world of people, places, and things. In a nutshell, what didn't happen if we experienced early emotional neglect is we were not taught to make proper sense of the relationship between our inner world and the outer world. So whereas trauma disrupts our systems of meaning-making, emotional neglect can interfere with our ability to form systems of meaning and to form coherent understandings of how the world works and what information it's important for us to be paying attention to and emotionally investing ourselves in. I remember seeing this joke on Twitter one time where someone was explaining what it's like as someone with CPTSD to listen to someone with PTSD speaking. And it went something along the lines of, person with PTSD, I just can't stop thinking about what my life was like before the trauma. Me, a person with CPTSD. Wait, there was a before for you? And obviously this is a joke, but what it highlights here is that while single instance trauma disrupts our ability to understand the world coherently, complex trauma, which can be the result of early emotional neglect, interrupts our ability to form a coherent worldview in the first place. So I remember really starting to draw my attention to the idea of emotional neglect when I was at a workshop where there was a speaker talking about how she had experienced trauma from early emotional neglect. And something she said that I never forgot was she spoke about a member of her immediate family dying when she was a child. And she said, nobody made that experience matter. And those words really stuck with me. The idea of making an experience matter felt so foreign to me, but also made total sense. When we are children, a lot of how we learn about emotional regulation is through social referencing. So something happens that maybe shocks or scares us. Maybe we're watching a scary movie and we look around and we kind of check. Is everybody else freaked out or are my caregivers looking calm? And then we learn how to, with increasing complexity, categorize our own inner experiences based on how the people around us are responding to the same stimuli. So if I feel really scared and then I look around and notice everyone else is just chatting and eating popcorn, I'm going to learn something along the lines of, when something scary happens but it's on the TV, I'm probably safe. Now, this is a very simple example. But when we have social referencing in our environment that does not properly map onto our inner states, this gets very confusing. So let's say you have a member of your immediate family die, but you exist inside of a family dynamic that's quite avoidant. So even though the members of your family might be feeling intense grief and loss, they might not be displaying those things. And so then when you're looking around and trying to kind of socially reference what's going on, I feel this deep sense of grief and loss, but everyone else looks kind of calm or is making jokes or isn't really paying attention to what happened. What we might internalize is this feeling of grief or intense loss that I feel is the wrong thing to feel because it doesn't match what I'm seeing from my environment. So in a healthy caregiving environment, it is the role of the parent or caregiver to see the child's inner world and to help them associate their inner emotions to what's happening in their environment. You feel grief, you feel sadness, you feel loss. Those are normal responses to someone you love passing away. It's a very simple example that's very clear to most of us. But this can also happen on a very subtle level all of the time. Maybe a child had a difficult interaction at school, but when they tell their parent about it, they don't seem to have any significant reaction. So the child figures, okay, maybe my feelings were hurt when this person said something to me about how I look or how I act, but I must just be too sensitive, or it must be wrong for me to have this response of upset. And then what happens is we start to develop shame-bound emotions. So I do have an entire video just on this that I'll link in the description of this video. But essentially what happens when our emotions become shame-bound is we start to believe that there are things we can feel that are wrong and that we ought not to feel. And this can lead to a whole host of emotional dysregulation issues. When we believe that the emotions we are feeling are not connected in a way that makes sense to our external environment. So we're going to get into some of the things you might struggle with as an adult if you experienced emotional neglect in childhood. But before we do that, I just want to quickly go over once again why emotions are so important to focus on and develop vocabulary around as children. Because there's often this kind of narrative out there that if you just toughen up and ignore your emotions, you're going to have an easier life. And that absolutely could not be further from the truth. Emotions are incredibly important pieces of information about what is happening in our environment and how our body is responding to what is happening. So what matters to us in life and what we ought to be paying attention to. If we ignore this, we are robbing ourselves of the ability to make good decisions, to stay aligned with what matters to us in life. And we are also likely to be missing very significant pieces of information that are necessary for processing the world in a logical and coherent way. Another tweet I saw one time that I really liked was comparing emotional sensitivity to intuitive eating. So in the philosophy of intuitive eating, it's all about paying attention to your body's cues and giving your body whatever food it wants, whenever it wants it. And the argument against intuitive eating is often, well, if I did that, I would just eat pizza all the time. But the argument this tweet was making was that that is actually not intuitive eating, because your body is very rarely craving super unhealthy foods. If you're actually attuned to your body and you're listening not just to its cravings for sugar and things like that, but also paying attention to what foods make your energy low, what foods are harder to digest, which foods are easiest on your system, you're actually probably going to be eating pretty healthily at the end of the day. Because you're not just paying attention to the super strong overt cues that your mind is giving you about what it wants to eat. You're actually really associated to your entire system. And you're looking at how everything you put in your body impacts the way that you feel. And the same is true for emotional attunement. So when I hear people say things like, if I were to pay more attention to my emotions, I would just be irrational and I would never get out of bed in the morning. I would become this lazy slob, whatever it is that they fear placing additional attention on their emotions would lead to. To be attuned to our emotional systems does not mean only listening to the part of ourselves that's telling us to stay in bed all day and be a slob. It means also listening to the emotions that tell us, hey, I want to feel good and proud of myself. So it's time for me to enact some discipline or to do some hard work to get myself to where I want to go. Those types of signals are also signals that our emotional systems give us when we are accurately attuned to them. Our bodies do not want us to wither away in bed. Our bodies want us to get up and live, but we have to be properly attuned to our bodies and to our emotions in order to get the whole picture in our minds. So what we're going to look at now is some of the ways we might struggle as adults if we had early experiences of emotional neglect. And then after that, we're going to look at what we can start doing to reverse this process and to become more attuned to and sensitive towards our emotional experience. So the number one thing that I think can be really challenging for people who had early emotional neglect is making decisions on both a large scale and a small scale. Our emotions are there to draw our attention to what matters most to us in life. If we have learned to dissociate from our emotions and tell ourselves it's not important to pay attention to them, what we are going to find is that it's really difficult for us to feel as though our lives have a deep sense of meaning. Because maybe we'll end up following all of these formulas that are set out by other people or by society for what leads to a good life without ever really...
And also keeping in mind, right, with what she said, keeping in mind that everybody's life has its own different formula. There's no one size fits all. Everybody's life is different. And we have to now come to terms with, okay, so this is maybe the formula that's going to work for me. And maybe this is something that's not going to work for me. But what do I want? And how do we navigate through life together? Eh? As me, myself, and I. And whoever is around me, like, hey guys, ooh, life.
Checking in on, does this fit for me? Do I feel aligned with these things? Is this what I want out of my life? And then we might end up feeling really depressed when we achieve all of these milestones and can't understand why we aren't happy. Or this could go in another direction, which can be that we are so disconnected from what makes us feel a certain way that we can get extremely neurotic about even the tiniest of decisions in our lives. So we can spend hours obsessing over what am I going to eat for dinner tonight? Or which shirt should I wear to this event? Because we don't really understand the big things that give our lives meaning. What the guiding principles of our lives and our well-being are. We can get super fixated on the little tiny hits of dopamine that we might be able to glean out of our day-to-day life. But at the end of the day, both of these scenarios leave us feeling pretty empty inside, which is probably a big reason why early emotional neglect tends to be associated with depression and anxiety in adulthood. When we don't know what matters in life, when we don't have our emotions as guiding principles, telling us, I care about this, I'm interested in this, this is an area where I feel as though my inner world can make a positive impact on my outer world. We don't really know how to make good decisions. Because again, we aren't attuned to the part of ourselves that is giving us constant information about that. Second thing that we frequently see with emotional neglect, toxic shame. So if you've been following this channel for a while, you have probably seen some videos I've put out on toxic shame and how it ties into emotional dysregulation. But if not, I'm going to link them in the description of this video, because toxic shame is inherently this belief that something about me is fundamentally broken, flawed, or wrong, and that if anyone got close enough to me, they would see that. And the reason why toxic shame often develops as a product of emotional neglect is because children experience shame when they put out bids for connection and have them rejected, or when there is some sort of rupture that goes unrepaired with their caregiver. Shame is the emotion that comes online to tell us what is likely to get us rejected from our environment. And so if simply being ourselves and displaying our emotions to our caregivers leads to chronic rejection, we are going to feel chronic shame, which is going to bleed into the belief there is something just fundamentally wrong with me. And that belief, the belief that the very core of who I am is shameful and needs to be hidden from others, leads to a whole host of other challenges, some of which you can check out in the videos I've linked below, some of which we're going to talk about in the remainder of this one. The next thing that might happen as a product of emotional neglect is developing a phobia of inner experiences. So this is a term that I came across for the first time in a book that I believe I have behind me, in this book right here, Coping with Trauma-Related Dissociation. And I found that this term really clicked some things into place for me. The idea of having a phobia of inner experiences is essentially the idea that there are certain emotional states we have absolutely no idea how to self-regulate around. So our body naturally tries to redirect us from them anytime we get close to them. However, once again, all emotions are really important as pieces of information. So if we have a phobia around the experience of anger, we're going to be missing out on really important pieces of information about where we need to set boundaries. Maybe when I was a child, if I experienced anger, I got left alone. And that experience of anger was overwhelming. I had no idea how to downregulate from it. My system learned to lock away conscious feelings of anger when they came up in my mind. So now maybe I automatically go into a freeze response.
Care that goes where you go. That's International Travel Insurance through NHP. We facilitate cover of up to 10 million Namibian dollars per member for medical emergencies abroad as part of your membership. No extra charge. To receive your policy within minutes, simply register at nhp.com.na before you travel. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Stop everything. These bargains at USave are too good to pass by. 4 kilos real good frozen mixed chicken portions, just 194.99 Namibian dollars. 5 kilograms pasta polana, 109.99 Namibian dollars. 10 kilogram top score instant maize porridge, also just 109.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams Rama 70% fat spread, just 27.99 Namibian dollars. 1 kilogram U brand frozen mixed vegetables, just 36.99 Namibian dollars. You save, I save. Yes, we all save. You save.
Anytime I start to experience anger in my body, if I don't know how to process sadness, maybe any time.
Let's listen to the good doctor, my dear. Let's listen to Heidi. Let's listen to Heidi telling us. Please, Shashino, whoa. I think that we can learn a lot from the information that she's sharing, and she is sharing it in such a way that it's most easy for us to understand here. All right? It's Friday, ladies and gentlemen, and we are taking a deep dive into this, trauma healing things. Yeah, we are healing, man. Yeah, we are healing and we are learning how to heal so that when we jump into 2026, we are going to most be okay. Yeah, it's November. So we got time. We got like 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 8 weeks. We got time. We got time. We got time.
Time my system begins to feel that emotion of sadness because it starts as a sensation in the body. My mind immediately finds something to distract me with. And all of a sudden, I don't know why, I just can't pay attention to what I was doing or what I was thinking about. And I need to be online looking at something or researching something that is changing my emotional state. I've flipped into a flight response. And this can go for any emotion that we failed to learn to regulate as children. It can become a kind of psychological no-go area in our minds that we often need a lot of trauma-informed help to access. And we're going to talk more about what that looks like in the latter part of this video. The next thing we might see as a product of early emotional neglect is this sense of what I call existential loneliness. So this idea, not just that there's nobody in my life right now who sees and understands me, which is kind of how we perceive of loneliness in general. Existential loneliness is this kind of feeling that it's impossible for us to be seen and known, period, because we didn't have that early mirroring when we needed it most. And when we were developing our sense of self. So our sense of self may have developed largely in isolation, and we might not have any idea that it's possible for other people to see and know us deeply. And that might be a very strong felt sense that we have. And to complicate this, if we do not know ourselves completely, because there are psychological no-go areas that we've developed defensively through that phobia of inner experience, now it's going to feel very true to us that we can't properly be seen or known because we do not properly see and know ourselves in our entirety. And other people can only meet us as deeply as we have met ourselves. And I think that for myself, one of the most profound shifts that has happened for me as I've been on this journey of attachment work is going from a sense of existential loneliness to the deep, profound belief in my body that I can be known. By developing intimacy first with myself and uncovering all of those no-go areas in my psyche, it became possible for me to communicate myself to other people in a way that I once thought was absolutely impossible. It wasn't a conscious belief I had, it was just a feeling in my body, that feeling of deep existential aloneness. And this feeling can be changed. And it's one of the core reasons why I'm so passionate about all of this. Because the more literacy we gain around ourselves and our own emotions, the more we learn how to connect with other people. And those connections are the things that make our lives feel meaningful and worth living. So this stuff is so important. It's so important to become aware of and to not dismiss inside of ourselves. But before we go through that process, another problem we might encounter if we've experienced early emotional neglect is chronic, unconscious self-abandonment. So if you've been around this channel for a while, you've probably heard me talk about self-abandonment. So essentially abandoning what we want for ourselves in an authentic way in favor of staying in connection with another person. And there are small instances where this isn't a big deal, right? You want to get sushi, your friend wants to get Indian, you go for Indian tonight. But when we are doing this chronically and unconsciously, it tends to be very alienating. And the reason why we will do this unconsciously and chronically if we've had early neglect is often because we have no idea that we can bring our authentic selves into connection. We may have internalized, if we have that toxic shame belief, the only way to be in connection with others is to figure out what they want and present myself as though I want that too. Or to act as though I am this absolutely perfect and ideal human being so that they can find no fault with me. And it might not even occur to us that there is such a thing as authentic connection, where we can be fully us and another person can see the whole of us. So both what we're good at, but also what we're struggling with and what we don't understand inside of ourselves. And another person can stay on the page with us for all of that, and that we can also hold space for other people in that same way. But again, I really think that for a lot of people who experienced early emotional neglect and internalized that belief that sharing any of my feelings or inner world is going to lead to rejection, self-abandonment is not even something we consciously think of. It's just something we automatically do. It's what we unconsciously believe is the price we have to pay to get any form of connection, even if it's entirely superficial. And so this is another one of those really deep, insidious beliefs that can shift over time with direct and targeted work on developing emotional literacy, on working on those toxic shame beliefs, and on learning to communicate our inner worlds without an overwhelm of shame getting in the way. Sixth thing that's very common with people who've experienced emotional neglect is that criticism hits incredibly hard, and you might feel highly, highly defensive to even the smallest hints from other people that you're not doing something perfectly. To integrate feedback without having our defenses online, we need to know that we are being seen as whole people by the people who are giving us that feedback. But if, once again, we have never really learned to share ourselves with people, nobody is going to be able to see us as whole people because we haven't been able to show them the full breadth of ourselves. So again, if we have that belief, I need to behave perfectly in order to stay in connection, someone giving us any form of negative feedback is probably going to be processed by our system as you don't want to be in connection with me at all and everything about me is wrong. When in reality, someone might really like 99% of us and just have one thing that they want to chat with us about because it's getting in the way of them being able to connect with us properly. And the reason you might feel so defensive when this happens is because you're used to the cost of mistake being really high if your only route to connection when you were young was behaving perfectly. So your body might go on high alert and start looking for any way you can find to prove that person that they are wrong about the criticism that they're giving you because you equate criticism with them writing you off entirely. So of course you're going to push back against it and try to make it not true instead of sitting with it and integrating it, which is something we can only really do well if we have a relatively secure attachment system. So I remember there was part of a support group that I was in for a while. And part of the process within this group, after we'd spent some time building trust together, was to give each other feedback, both on what our first impressions of each other had been, for better and for worse, as well as where people thought we could be doing better. So where people perceived our areas for growth to be. And I remember sitting there waiting for this circle to come around to me, absolutely terrified, and just thinking, this is my worst nightmare. But then when it actually happened, it was very interesting. Because I'd gotten to know the people in this group pretty well. They'd seen me in vulnerable states, and I'd seen them in vulnerable states. And so when they were giving me feedback, I had this sense of, this is coming from a place of care. these people are actually seeing me very clearly, and they're bringing into my awareness opportunities for growth that I could take, but they're not using those critiques to write me off as a person. They're using them to help me ameliorate my own experience. And that was the first time I think I really got in my body what it was like to receive criticism that was actually very well-intentioned. And that's not to say that I'd never received well-intentioned criticism before in my life, just that this was the first time my body really deeply logged it as what was happening, because there was a high degree of interpersonal trust and the idea that these people saw me as a whole person built into the whole dynamic. And this is ideally the place we want to get to as we work through that early emotional neglect and we learn to share ourselves more completely with others. Criticism is going to start looking less scary to us because we know that people also see our strengths and our vulnerabilities. And so they're not rejecting us on the whole when they give us feedback. In a lot of cases, they're actually trying to help. But once again, this is the opposite of how we're going to process this if we are dealing with significant emotional neglect that we have not yet started to work on. And the last thing we're going to look at here is something you're likely to struggle with if you had early emotional neglect, is that you have trouble with the relationship between your subjective inner world and the objective outer world, and understanding both how you impact the world around you and how your environment impacts you. So there is a field of psychology called object relations that kind of harks back to Freud. And I just want to be clear that that isn't specifically what I'm referencing here, though there might be some overlap in what I'm saying. What I'm talking about here is that there's just an inadequate amount of feedback between our inner worlds and our outer worlds, because we haven't been taught how to manage the connection between those two things. So if I'm feeling something strong in my body, but I don't see a very obvious and overt reason in my external environment why I might be feeling that, instead of getting really attuned to my environment and trying to figure out where might this be coming from, what subtle things might be kind of adding up in the background of my life that are culminating in this emotional experience that I'm having. And I'm going to really examine the links between what's going on in my outer world and what's going on in my inner world. That's what we're able to do when we're attuned to both things. When we're not attuned to those things, if we don't see a super overt reason in our outer world why we're maybe upset, we're just going to go, I'm crazy. There is no cause for my being upset. I'm just being my irrational self again. So that experience gets covered up by shame and the information that whatever feeling we were having is trying to give us goes underground and we don't process it. Or the opposite could be true. We could feel a super strong emotion and just pick something in our external world to blame it on and to go, well, I'm feeling this, so X, Y, or Z must be happening. Someone must be behaving maliciously towards me or whatever it is. Because again, we don't have the inner and outer attunement skills to pick up on more subtle dynamics in our environment and how subtleties impact our emotional and our inner world. In order to do that well, we have to have pretty good emotional literacy, and we also have to have a pretty good understanding of what events impact us in what ways. So in my attachment healing journey, there were multiple points where I would be talking to someone who is more securely attached than me, and I would hear them complain about something. And I would go, I would never think to complain about that thing. To me, that thing is just a part of everyday life. You just ignore your feelings about it and you get on with things. But then I would experience chronic emotional dysregulation, intermittent depression, etc., etc., etc. And I had to start realizing that these things other people are making into a big deal might actually be these people processing the emotions that they're feeling at the volume that they're feeling them at the time that they're feeling them. And that is what healthy emotional expression looks like. It means being sensitized to and understanding which things impact us emotionally, and in turn, how we can take care of ourselves and interact with our lives in a way that maximizes our emotional health and well-being. And when we have a very significant disconnect in this area, it can lead to things like delusions or forms of schizophrenic thought patterns, and we're not going to go into that today just because that is not my area of specialty and I would not be able to do it justice. But in the kind of moderate range, we get things like, for example, limerence, which is something we talk a lot about on this channel. So I have this memory of years ago, catching up with a friend of mine who had been dumped about a year prior by this girl he'd been dating who he really liked. and I remember him talking about her as though their breakup had happened like a week ago. And he was saying, yeah, I just still have these really strong feelings for her. And I remember thinking, well, how could you possibly have feelings for this person you have not had any contact with in a year? Because the person she is now could be totally different than the person she was a year ago. And that person is someone you don't have a connection with. But he didn't seem to realize that. His inner world was holding on to the past, and it's almost like it wasn't updating fast enough. It wasn't taking the feedback from the outer world, which is that this person was no longer in his life, and adjusting his inner world accordingly. And this is, on a large or small scale, what often happens to us when we have significant impairments in our emotional processing. We aren't doing enough checking between our inner and outer world. So when we have healthy, secure attachment systems, what we're frequently doing is sharing our inner world with other people and getting feedback on it. And then that feedback that we get from other people, we then use to update our inner world of feelings and thoughts and perceptions. And this happens continuously in a never-ending way for the entirety of our lives. But when we have learned that our emotional world and our outer world shouldn't or don't or can't interact in a meaningful way, we can experience really big disconnects between how we're feeling or thinking and making sense of the world and the way that the world actually is. So when it comes to healing from emotional neglect, what we're trying to do is get to a place where we are doing more reality checking on a more frequent basis. So where our inner and outer world are interacting with each other more frequently and in a less distorted way. So now we're going to move into what it looks like to start to heal from emotional neglect and what it takes to start targeting these problems at their core. Healing from emotional neglect can be an insidious task because the very thing that we need to heal from it, which is mentorship from our environment, is the very thing that emotional neglect tends to tell us is useless or impossible for us. But healing from emotional neglect is the process of making our own feelings, including our own pain, matter, because we need those feelings to navigate the world in a way that makes sense. And we are probably going to need a lot of help getting to the place where we understand what value to give which emotions. So the first step in this process is often increasing our emotional literacy. And this is something that can be done to a large extent through things like reading or watching YouTube videos or listening to podcasts and just developing more language for what it is that we are feeling and for which types of feelings tend to be connected to which things in our environment. Another thing we want to do in this process is get better at self-attunement. So I do have a video about this. I will link in the description of this one. But when we are self-attuning, essentially what we are doing is we're learning to draw connections between what we're feeling and what's happening in the world outside of ourselves. It's kind of like keeping a food diary. So when I was learning about intuitive eating, I used to write down about 20 minutes after I ate anything how I was feeling physically in my body to start drawing my awareness to eventual patterns around which foods impacted my energy levels in which ways. And this is something that I also recommend if you're trying to get more emotionally attuned. Pick points throughout the day to sit down and routinely write out what's going on for you at that point in the day, as well as how you're feeling. And I go over this process in much more detail in that video on self-attunement, so I recommend checking it out if this is an area that is new to you. But the important thing here is that we are learning to draw our awareness to what it is that we're feeling and when and why. So we're learning to see our inner world as connected to our external environment in a way that might feel somewhat unfamiliar to us. The next thing we're going to work on is practicing to increase our tolerance level to all emotions. So it's highly likely if you experienced early emotional neglect that there are one or several feelings that you do have either those shame binds or those inner phobias of. So for myself, I used to have an inner phobia around anger. And if I got too angry, one of two things would happen. I would have a chronic pain flare up that would totally shut down my system for a couple of days, or I would experience an overwhelming urge to get drunk. And it wasn't until I began working with a therapist who was able to be present with me as I was somatically experiencing anger and stay on the page with me and help me learn skills for both expressing and downregulating that anger that those instinctive body responses of pain or addiction started to naturally disappear. So therapists, particularly ones who have a somatic element to the work that they do, can work as really great space holders for us as we go into those experiences and learn to tolerate staying present with them. So staying with them without dissociating or without having that flight response that takes us out of the experience. And the more that we learn to tolerate those feelings that we are most afraid of, the more we're able to integrate them into our awareness, which helps us make better decisions across the board. And we might need to look for different environments to hold different types of emotions. So when I was learning to work with anger, I worked with my therapist, but I also did a lot of work with a community called Radical Honesty that places a really big focus on accessing and cleanly expressing anger. When I was learning skills for tolerating intimacy, I leaned heavily on the community of authentic relating, which teaches staying present with expressions of interpersonal intimacy. When I was working on staying present with feelings of sexuality, I leaned on the Tantra community, which helps us learn to tolerate sexual energy in the body. And when I was learning to tolerate feelings of pain and sadness, I leaned heavily on Buddhism, where they would do teachings on staying present with grief. So what we often need to do at this point in the process is find environments where we can not just cognitively think about which emotions we need to integrate, but where we can actually get in touch with them in the moment and somatically experience them with the help of those who are trained in containing these types of emotions. So this is about going out into the world and finding the containing environments that we needed when we were young, but did not get. And once again, that emotional neglect patterning might be telling us, there's nothing out there that's going to help me. There's no one out there who's going to be able to give me the feedback I need. And if I try or put myself in any of these environments and show these emotions, I'm going to get rejected. And so that belief might be something that we need to work through first in order to even develop the nerve to go out and put ourselves in these situations where we can have firsthand somatic experiences of those emotions that we have been repressing. So again, this process doesn't happen overnight, but hopefully we can lay out a bit of a groundwork of what it can look like overall. So this has already bled into the third thing we really want to place our focus on in the healing process from emotional neglect, which is finding mentors. Emotional neglect is in large part an interpersonal wound, which means that the healing from it has to happen in large part interpersonally. So we need to go out into the world and deliberately search for people who are embodying the qualities that we know we are emotionally deprived in, and finding ways to seek out mentors who can help us grow in those areas. I remember having a conversation with a mentor of mine at one point where she said, you're used to thinking of the environment around you as an emotionally impoverished place. So you have stopped searching for ways in which the opposite could be true. And if you're really serious about healing from emotional neglect, you have to believe that there are ways in which your environment can and will be able to nourish your inner world, and you have to go out searching for them. And that piece of advice was one that hit home really hard and that changed my life in very big ways. We have often cut ourselves off from even the option of thinking about the outer world as a place that could provide us with accurate mirroring, with co-regulation, with meaningful feedback on our inner world, and with really enriching experiences that will change our inner world for the better if we are not used to interacting with it in a wholehearted way. And this all builds on itself, because the more we get to know ourselves and what our needs are, the more we're able to go out and find mentors who very specifically can help us fulfill those needs. So those mentors might be coaches, they might be therapists, they might be community members, they might be friends. But the idea is that we just need to start believing those people are out there. There are competent and compassionate adults out there who have significant nourishing things they could provide to our lives, and vice versa. This might feel completely counterintuitive, and because it's so counterintuitive to the way that you think, it's often what holds the key to changing your worldview. Because at the end of all of this, we want to arrive at a place where we believe that our environments are places where we could get nourishment from, and that we could give nourishment back to, which leads us to the final step, which is living in a state of constant give and take with our environment. And this is what it looks like to have a secure connection to the world. We are allowing ourselves to go into new situations and to meet people from a place of wholeness and openness. So we're both receptive to what our environments have to offer us, and we are also not withholding our own feelings and our own perceptions and our own inner worlds. So there's a natural give and take that we now have between our subjective world and the objective world around us. So this requires self-attunement and once again, getting to really deeply know ourselves and understand ourselves so that we get clear on things like how to stay in authentic connection with people in a way that is boundaried and that protects our inner world, but also how to not erect those boundaries so high that we never have the chance for genuine connection with other people. This also requires learning attunement to other people. So learning to stay on the page with people and get really curious about their inner worlds and their experiences and coming to understand how our inner world and other people's inner worlds are different, but can very significantly enrich each other's. A kind of formal practice that's helped me a lot with this is the practice of circling. So this is kind of an interpersonal meditation process that gets practiced in groups. So if you're curious about it, you can go online and try to find an online circling group, or there might be groups that meet in the place that you live. But essentially, this is all about engaging in practices that allow you to stay in authentic connection with other people, which opens up that continuous feedback cycle between you and your environment so that you're understanding how the world is impacting you and how you can impact the world. And the more we do that, and the more we get attuned to the relationship between subject and object and how it is never not happening, even if we deny it, the more we make sense of ourselves and the more we find our place in the world, the more our lives become meaningfully directed and the less chaos and confusion we feel internally. So there are so many benefits to all of this, but it all starts with recognizing that something like emotional neglect, if we have experienced it, can lead to very massive disturbances in the way that we are processing the world and our inner world as adults. It's not a small thing to have not received proper emotional guidance and context for how to make sense of our inner world. So this has been a lot of information, and I'm going to leave it at that for today. But as always, anything that's coming up for you guys as you go through this video, please leave in the comments section below. I love you guys. I hope you're taking care of yourselves and each other, and I will see you back here again really soon.
Sure. What a hell of a conversation, ladies and gentlemen. It has been wild. It has been wild. It has been wild. But we are still learning how to deal with the traumas. But maybe we should also look at father wounds and, you know, daddy issues and stuff like that. We should also look at that and how it might play into our relationship traumas that we are trying to heal from. Some wounds that we have caused upon each other and ourselves, and some wounds that we didn't inflict on ourselves. It came from our parents.
Great news! Impa just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Impa? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Impa has to offer at an unbeatable price. Impa, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
I'm going to structure each type along with the impact on a daughter in the following ways. I'm going to talk about the impact on a daughter's sense of self. I'm going to talk about the impact on a daughter's mental health. I'm going to talk about the impact of a daughter's sense of men, like the blueprint of men, what is modeled inside and outside the home, and the impact on a daughter's replication of childhood dynamics and projection. And after, I'll talk about healing goals to kind of achieve with each type and what might be good to specifically do or work on if you identify with these types of fathers. Many daughters of toxic fathers can be caught up in what feels like perpetual cycles of dysfunctional dynamics with men because of that direct early influence of their father, like the father's moods, his inability to connect with you, how he saw you, how he didn't see you, how he treated women in general, and if he was a stranger to you. And if you struggle with or have struggled with toxic dynamics with unavailable men, unsafe men, men you can't seem to like get through to about their mental health, men who are close to you but they feel like they're still a stranger, navigating and getting out of those dynamics with men will start with looking at our first relationship with a man, which is going to be a father. It's possible to catch these dynamics and step out of them, which is kind of like what every childhood trauma survivor kind of wants, whether it's with a male you maybe work with, a male you're dating, or you're still caught up with issues with your own father right now in the middle of this video. So if you identify as queer or you don't date men, this video will be applicable and hopefully helpful to you as well. If you're a male and you want to understand your female partner better and yourself better and possibly your own father, the info here can also help you too. All childhood trauma survivors have men in their story. And if you didn't know your biological father, he affected you. When I got to therapy, I didn't really think I had much work to do around my father because I had already like psychologically written him off. And I didn't get at that time how much unfinished psychological business I had with my own father. And maybe you relate to that, like writing him off perhaps early in your life, because that is actually a common thing with childhood trauma. Despite my language here, this video is not about bashing men or making sweeping anti-male statements. We are specifically talking about a highly abusive and or toxic types of fathers in this video, and they are not universal to every single man. And there will most likely be a counterpart video about what happens to men in toxic relationships with their mothers or with their fathers as well. Today, we're going to be exploring those specific types of toxic fathers and their impact on daughters specifically. If we can understand that, then maybe we can fix patterns that we're having with men in general. And if you don't know me, I'm Patrick Tian. I'm an MSW. And this channel is all about childhood trauma, specifically coming from our family of origin, like as a system, as well as discovering ways for our recovery and for our better mental health. Before I start, while any childhood trauma survivor can be exposed to toxicity in childhood by a parent, it's not what that child would have chosen. So when I say toxic father and daughter dynamics, I'm not saying it's your fault, nor is a daughter responsible for the father's mess or his legacy with his own children. I am saying that because of unfinished unconscious business from our fathers, we can get caught up in toxic dynamics with them or with people in our present lives. Which leads us to the first lasting problem. What we need to address is that we can end up in toxic adult relationships in our present lives due to having a toxic parent. That's the part that we really need to get real about and kind of step out of. And also, I'm listing what I've seen in 14 years of private practice as a group therapist, an individual therapist, as a couples therapist, and also with nearly 30 years of my own recovery in general. But I want you to really take this in. You're the expert about your relationship and your reactions in context of your father. This is your process. I'm listing patterns that I've seen. You don't have to necessarily agree with it. And as a male, I've experienced both a toxic mother and a father, but obviously not as a daughter, along with how society views and treats daughters. So now let's explore some lasting problems or the cycles of having a toxic father, even if he's not in your life. Here are the big three lasting problems in having a toxic father for daughters. Number one, most importantly with a toxic father, daughters tend to get stuck in replicating dynamics in their relationship, mainly their romantic relationships. This is in the form of projection. That's going to look like that replication and projection, replicating the old dynamics, is going to look like dating the same kind of dysfunctional person, like in a pattern. It's going to look like giving up power, your personal power, or defaulting to men or defaulting to the masculine to avoid being in trouble. Replication is going to look like trying to control a partner, like trying to get them healthier or save a partner either from themselves or save them from somebody else. It's going to look like seeking connection or approval from older men. I know that that sounds icky, but that's a thing for both men and women in childhood trauma. Or trying to get an aloof or moody man to see you or tolerate you. Replication is also going to look like being extremely dysregulated around men or flat out hating them in general. All of these are examples of the replication, and most importantly, that our inner child projects those dynamics. It's just how that stuff works. Like, it's maybe your job to rescue a man, or that all men are rageful and unpredictable, or men are incapable, so you have to do all the work, like in the concept of weaponized incompetence, which is a thing in the present. To our inner child, these can feel viscerally true to survivors, and we have to explore projection of the toxic father that we had that happens where projecting that onto our present. I'm not saying in any way that men are 1,000% safe. Past and present childhood trauma work is highly nuanced and tricky. I'll say more about that later. The second of the big lasting three is that you might be currently still struggling with a toxic father in your present life. Do you maybe still have to chase him to connect and you have to put in 5 times the effort? Does maybe he blame you for your emotions or put you down, or that you're scared of him even when he isn't around? Does he behave in an immature way or create chaos or drama? Is he still a stranger to you? Like, does he put in any work to get to know you? Or is he a mess that you have to help out and rescue and be a parent for? Do you have to deal with him or navigate him instead of enjoying his company? Like with any toxic parent, when we're still engaged in a battle with them or a power struggle with them, or we default to a weird codependent dance with them, we're still in it, and it highly affects us. Despite you as the daughter, you might be used to it on some level. Actually, when we get healthier, we tolerate less, and we kind of really recognize that things are really taxing to our system. So in these present problems, part of healing might be about the need to engage less, or withdraw, or shift your energy around this parent. Not to do the same old, like trying to get him interested in his own daughter by trying again and again, or trying to get him interested in his grandchildren. And the third one of the big three is how a daughter feels about herself as a lasting problem. As a society, we still don't recognize how important fathers are for our sense of self and our development. Like an example is, do you still struggle to feel lovable or valuable, not just with your father? Has your worth ever been only based upon how you look? Do you still believe you have to be a certain specific way to be loved by a man? This is hard, but are you more familiar with things like neglect or disrespect or immaturity from a man? And maybe the opposite of those things feel uncomfortable or foreign. And this is hard, but are you more familiar with things like neglect or disrespect or immaturity from a man? And maybe the opposite of those things feel foreign. Remember what I said earlier about these are not things that we would have chosen, meaning we are not responsible for those stuck places. I mean, we are responsible for the healing, but no one would have asked for those things. So parents have a lot of power, if not all the power, to tell their children who they are, and either directly or indirectly or through neglect. So deep in our core, how they felt about us is how we feel about us. But toxic people no longer get to tell us who we are. Remember that. Moving on, here are some complicating outside factors in these toxic father-daughter dynamics. Here are some things we need to address before getting into the types of toxic fathers. And there are some additional complicating factors for daughters of toxic fathers. These are things that daughters are taught at home and in their community and cultures that will amp up the toxic father-daughter dynamics. First is growing up and living in a patriarchal male-dominated culture. And actually, we're kind of hard-pressed to find a culture that isn't patriarchal in that way. But as daughters, you might have had to grow up in things like a toxic belief that girls are more likely to bring shame onto a family or a community rather than what boys do. In kind of in a very hypocritical way, a part of what can bring a woman down more in society and in her family, for the most part, is perpetuating men. But we see this as a culture that shames women about an interaction with a male versus as seeing the male's behavior first. Also at home, what a mother models in response to the toxic father at home, like minimizing the abusive father's behavior or concluding that all men are like that, is a powerful, complicating factor that affects daughters and their conditioning. An abused mother can model self-blame. A toxic mother can model unstable relationships with men. A mother can be a hostage without any power. If your mother spent her life defaulting to or chasing moody, unavailable men, that's going to have an impact on both daughters and sons. Another complicating factor is there can also be internal misogyny from a mother to her daughter, or being taught that it's your fault about whatever happens because you're a woman and you should know better, or women are manipulative. And as a side note, men who have gone through childhood trauma with a toxic mother also have their own damaging paradoxes at home and in society. No child in the toxic family is unaffected by these kind of dynamics. Two common paradoxes in men is that the man who is too submissive to a woman, due to having an abusive mother, like that mother had a belief that men should never upset a woman and be totally selfless, and that could be additionally modeled by a codependent father. He was taught that women are always innocent, which gets him into abusive relationships, or he can be very unreal or passive if he's in a relationship with you. The other paradox, and this is difficult to explain, but men having a lot of projection and rage and contempt for women, this is like toxic masculinity, because their mother was potentially codependent or manipulative, or it was modeled by a toxic father. And I see unsafe men as often having this hypervigilance about seeking out and finding hypocrisy in women. You'll kind of see it if you think about it in a way that they're always trying to find the shadiness in women as part of a trait in toxic masculinity. Daughters can get caught up in similar damaging choices and dynamics to submit to the opposite sex or have conditioned contempt for the opposite sex. And then there is patriarchal and misogynistic and misandry that happens inside and outside of the home. It's really a mess for childhood trauma survivors, and there are always two highly impacted inner children in a relationship of any and all gender identities, not just cisgender, as I've discussed here, that come from dysfunctional or toxic families. Think about it this way. What biases did your father perhaps have about women? What biases did your mother maybe have about men? What biases did your father have about men? What biases did your mother have about women? For a lot of childhood trauma survivors, that is a huge kind of can of unconscious worms to unpack. And everyone's situation will be nuanced. I'm just suggesting to you, the viewer, to explore deeper about what and where some of these issues can come from, especially around projection and replication, and I'll explain more in a moment. Okay, so to check in a little bit about those complicating factors, what came up for you around that? How might the culture that you grew up in, both inside and outside of your home, how might have all of that has kind of supported the abuse from a father? Just kind of a thought around that. Just as simply if I were to say the type of men in my home, like my father, were similar to the men on like the baseball field for coaches. Not all men. Some men were very, very helpful in that way. But the town that I grew up in was like aggro. So that's what I mean. And those two things had an impact. And in another way, the outside stuff was supporting the inside stuff and vice versa is what I'm trying to say. Okay, so here are the types of toxic fathers and the impact on their daughters. So let's look at the types and the types of dynamics with the toxic father and how they impact their daughters. I'm going to give a trigger warning here as some of these are intense. I'm going to structure each type along with the impact on a daughter in the following ways. I'm going to talk about the impact on a daughter's sense of self. I'm going to talk about the impact on a daughter's mental health. I'm going to talk about the impact of a daughter's sense of men, like the blueprint of men, what is modeled inside and outside the home, and the impact on a daughter's replication of childhood dynamics and projection. And after, I'll talk about healing goals to kind of achieve with each type and what might be good to specifically do or work on if you identify with these types of fathers. So I've isolated the five types of fathers that contribute to toxic dynamics as the unsafe perpetrator or the monster, the absent father or the untouchable father, the enmesher who kind of creates special relationships, the tragic codependent who's also an abused person too, and the crazy maker who creates a lot of chaos. So let's start. Here is the unsafe perpetrator or the monster. Trigger warning with this type. Getting the most damaging type of toxic father out of the way first, the unsafe perpetrator can be physically, sexually, and emotionally abusive and unsafe. They are ruled by anger, manipulation, and cycles of mood escalation. They can range from being like the boogeyman with legal issues and no one seems to be able to control to simply the guy at home who has outburst and punches walls as a way to communicate what he is feeling or make a statement, make people afraid. They tend to not really have relationships. They usually take hostages. They can have a serious mental health diagnosis. They can have substance abuse, or they can have CPTSD. A daughter of a monster experiences them as terrifying, very powerful. It's a very extremely tenuous relationship. It's hot and cold, and it's also unpredictable. Here is the impact on a daughter. Her sense of self, a daughter of an unsafe perpetrator can always feel like she's in trouble. And her real self is bad and unwanted, and it's highly dangerous and confusing to be the real you. The impact on her mental health is you can struggle here with intense general hypervigilance, anxiety, dissociation, shame, and fear, along with the fawning trauma response, as well as some consistent dread. The impact on our sense of men is the blueprint is like men dominate by weaponized mood, and you need to comply to be safe or hide the real you. Men are dangerous and not to be trusted or dealt with because they're like time bombs. And the dynamic is you might have to walk on eggshells regardless of the type of man that it is. And the impact on the replication and projection with the monster is a daughter can find herself in very similar relationships with partners who are unsafe, or a daughter can project that perpetrating father onto other people who are actually safe. That looks like interpreting a partner's frustration as violence instead of seeing the frustration as normal. So more on that later. Moving on to the next type of father is the absent stranger or the untouchable father. The absent father is a range from never knowing one's biological father to having a father or stepfather in your entire childhood, but he is a stranger to you and vice versa. He doesn't intervene in any way in your life, growing up or even now. He doesn't protect you from siblings or an abusive mother. He doesn't know your birthday or what you do for a living. He defaults to your mother, who has to put him on the phone, and it's awkward at best. He avoids all parental responsibility. When he does engage, it's still neglectful somehow or feels off, and he can show up at times if it's easy or beneficial to him. The absent stranger fathers can be any of these. They can be totally physically absent and you don't know him. They can be present but a stranger. They can be totally self-consumed. They can be emotionally immature. They can be emotionally limited, shut down, and preoccupied with anything but his daughter. He can be disinterested or profoundly blocked in not knowing how to connect, which is another version of it. What makes him untouchable could be his childhood, could be substance abuse, could be a mental health diagnosis, or he can range from being really narcissistic to really being limited and shut down and not knowing how to connect with a daughter or connecting with anyone else, not even knowing himself. It often feels like, sadly, that a pet would be more important to him than his own daughter. The absent stranger can also be more connecting with a son, but not a daughter. That's another dynamic there. Here's the impact on a daughter. Her inner child can assume that a father like this just doesn't think you're maybe worth it enough, which actually wasn't true. The impact on her mental health is that she can have core beliefs that contribute to depression and anxiety that can often be about not feeling good enough and some shame. There can also be hypervigilance about being forgotten or abandoned. Her sense of men can become icky people to avoid as if they were aliens because they were aliens, or that you have to work a million times more to convince a man to be interested in you, which is really too much on anyone to put in that amount of work. The replication and projection dynamic, a daughter here can get caught up in chasing being known by men. And since there wasn't protection, a daughter can also project that their partner is aloof or disinterested over normal stuff like a partner being tired or preoccupied. There can be rage about not connecting. The third type of toxic father is the enmesher, who creates a special relationship. While I don't see them as common as the last two, it is an issue with a father when the father overshares, crosses boundaries, is more like a high school kind of messy friend than an actual father. The enmesher is looking for camaraderie and care and validation from you. The enmesher can seek out from you what he does not get in his other relationships with adult women. He struggles with maturity, and his daughters tend to have to parent him. He might actually be very fun and feel safer, but he isn't a father. It's about him. Here is the impact on a daughter. Her sense of self with the enmesher can feel like her sense of self is about being available to others only, and reciprocal relationships feel very foreign or uncomfortable. The impact on her mental health can be anxiety about what is shared, depression related to not being seen, triggers around things like secrets and sharing, and hypervigilance about information and relationships. There can be shame about loose boundaries, gossiping being negative or stuff like that. Her sense of men is men might be safer than women, but they really don't show up for you at the end of the day. And intimacy is about them, gossip again, or their struggles. The replication and projection issue is a daughter of an enmesher can find themselves with men who are the focus and possibly projecting feelings of being used or rage about things like disclosure, rage about trust. An important side note about replication and projection in all these is I don't believe that childhood trauma survivors attract monsters or meshers or absent people or crazy makers. Childhood trauma survivors were never protected from such people and it got normalized. There's a difference to that. Moving on to the fourth one, the tragic codependent or the safer parent, the abused too. The tragic codependent father behaves as like a selfless punching bag. He models to take it from the abusive person, the other abusive adult in the family. He never uses his parental power to protect or his personal power to say is enough to the abusive spouse. He behaves like a co-victim with his daughters or a peer. Does that with maybe his other children too. A huge prevalent trait here. This is very important. He often operates from a broken philosophy that the abuser can't help it. And taking the abuse from the abuser is the morally right thing to do. And change or breakthrough or getting out of that is terrifying to him, or he doesn't even contemplate it. He can range from at least knowing that he is stuck and to not even seeing the abuse to himself and his children, and he might think that that's all normal. And he can range from at least knowing that he's stuck and he's being abused to not even seeing it as abuse to himself or to his children can be very normal to him, which is bizarre. He can be clueless. He can be martyred. He has a high crossover with the enmesher because he can often align with you as a co-victim of the mother who is abusing him or you. Typically a mother. He could have a same-sex partner. Typically when a daughter tries to address it or get her needs met, he will say stuff like, well, you know how she is, or worse, you know what I have to put up with. The tragic codependent is probably the most complex father on this list to process in therapy. We often view them as safer. They can feel safer in direct comparison to the blatantly abusive parent and also safer in the way that they may try to connect with you. They're connecting, but they're not protecting. Here's the impact on the daughter. This is the impact on her sense of self. Daughters of a tragic codependent father, like the enmesher, can feel like they only exist for someone else's pain. Having watched their father be victimized while not protecting their daughter, she doesn't really know herself. Here is the impact on her mental health. The daughter can struggle with rage triggers and hypervigilance about people not doing the right thing. Like it's an unconscious thing, not being able to pair those two things, the father's behavior to people not standing up and doing the right thing. There can also be abandonment. There can be anxiety about protecting others or others needing to change. Triggers around things like cowardice and hypocrisy are big triggers. Her sense of men, it is the blueprint, is men can be impossible barriers to get through to. Men might need the most help in her mind, like the underdog. Men are there, but men are absent. There can be shame about not helping enough or not being helped. Or really complicated, like projection feelings that men should always be available and always be empowered and selfless. I think that those are good qualities in men, but if it's coming from your inner child about what they should be, a daughter can feel disgust with anyone who isn't those things. The replication projection is a daughter of a tragic codependent can experience unconscious rage or disgust with codependent men or feel compelled to support men no matter what, perhaps protecting them from other women, if that makes sense. Daughters can replicate trying to save or awaken a male due to this type of father. And also, this type of toxic father is greatly contributes to a distrust of other women in general, on top of what the mother modeled. Moving on to the last one, the crazy maker, the chaos father. The crazy maker father can range from having substance abuse issues to hoarding to general immaturity. He is like a big kid, and he can be seen mature in some places, like maybe his job, but he was really a mess in relationships. The crazy maker toxic father behaves in contradictions. They can tell you they love you, but they never show up. Their relationships with women are often codependent or highly dysfunctional. They can make poor choices and are oblivious to the emotional impact on their children or even anyone else. They can be impulsive financially and vocationally and romantically. The crazy maker toxic father are not always outwardly or blatantly abusive, and they often have overlap with the enmesher with their daughters. But they can get nasty, however, if you push them about their dysfunction due to their profound immaturity. So this really falls under the emotionally immature parent. The crazy maker no-shows to your graduation after just telling you that they will be there, and then act like it was fate's fault about not showing up. Not something that they dropped the ball on or made a conscious choice about. They are incapable of accountability. He is incredibly hard to pin down or even get answers out of. And growing up, he could forget to pick you up and then minimize the importance or the impact on you. It's all about him. I'm not saying this is like a narcissistic NPD father. This can be an incredibly emotionally immature father as well. Can be both. It's not always that. They believe that their intentions are the truth. They intended on meeting your firstborn, so what's the problem if they didn't show up? They can be very slippery and avoidant, yet sometimes kind of also fun and positive, so it's tough. They can be a little bit of that safer parent as well, but they can also be rigid and detached from their impact on their daughters. Here is the impact on a daughter. The impact on her sense of self as a daughter of a crazy maker can always feel the burden of having to be the parent in the room, and receiving help or being the focus can feel really uncomfortable or foreign. Parentified children do not get to develop a healthy sense of self since they are in a role, they're not really a self. The daughter can also feel incredibly not important enough for someone to get it together. Like, sense of self was skipped over into an instant adulthood experience because the father never took her or their relationship or anything really seriously. The impact on her mental health is anxiety, shame, and stress. Possible coping like overdoing it or people-pleasing for people. She can struggle with letting go over triggers around disappointment or hypervigilance about trusting people and simply shame that that was your father. Her sense of men is the blueprint as you cannot rely on or trust men in any way, ranging into, like say, a codependent fantasy that you can change men from immature to mature. The replication projection is a daughter can find herself again with similar romantic partners, or they can find a good enough partner but still project onto them feelings like that partner is a loose cannon and you can't trust them. Daughters can also project onto anyone that they're a loose cannon and possibly might need to kind of be a bit controlling around them. Or they can project rage when others are either incompetent or feel like they're manipulative because that crazy maker father was both. Those are the five types and the types of impact that a father has on a daughter. Leave a comment about what really stood out for you if I name something important to you. And also, many of those traits will overlap and it's common, which I'll talk more about later. What really jumped out at you? And if you're a male watching this, how is your experience similar with a father? Or how does your pattern of struggles with relationship, how is that kind of similar? Here are some general healing goals and ideas with each type of toxic father. In all of these, if you're still in these toxic dynamics with your own father, seek out resources such as therapy or Codependence Anonymous or Codependent No More. That's a book by Melody Beattie on getting some skills together about how to detach from them instead of doing the same old battle with a father like this or trying to get them to see you and still getting abused and let down. Space, boundaries, and resources, maybe taking a break, withdrawing, things like no contact or low contact are all things you can look into. So here are the healing goals for each of the five types. Let's start with the unsafe perpetrator, the monster. Try to stop trying to figure out the monster's behaviors and their motives. They aren't safe, and figuring out why they do something abusive doesn't change that they're abusive. Our inner child wants to know why they do certain things as if that's going to really help something. They think the why will have everything make sense when it doesn't. The other healing goal is try to work on and recognize patterns of projecting the monster onto your partners or other men in your life. We lose a person's humanity, whoever we project upon. Projection can also be about doing a familiar dance with a man, like managing his emotions or believing that their frustration is about you and your fault. It's all about how the inner child reacts to someone. The last is finding tangible emotional anger and empowerment about your father of origin. While exploring things like the fawning response, getting some information on that. Monsters tend to rob us of our personal power, and we want our daughters to have power in their lives, power in their choices, power in their thoughts, and power about themselves. Here are the healing goals about the non-protective and absent father or the untouchable father. One is to process abandonment in therapy and find healthy, tangible anger, holding this father accountable as a thought exercise and a process. Another is stop trying to maybe fix the mystery. Our inner child, like the monster, wants to know why this father abandoned us in reality or in the day-to-day when we were living with them. That inner child actually needs emotional help to process what happened. The why really kind of never heals. Work with your inner child about projecting abandonment onto maybe other men or your partner. Third healing goal with the enmesher is recognize that poor boundaries are not actually special. And the missing parental hierarchy that you needed from a dad and the responsibility that he got out of. Like, you lost out on being someone's daughter and became kind of the mother or a surrogate to him. The other healing goal here is to stop confusing poor boundaries or responsibility for intimacy. And lastly is to help your inner child see that fixing them means to abandon yourself. Here are the healing goals for the tragic codependent. Recognize that they had the power to protect you as their daughter, but they didn't, despite how it looks. Recognize that they modeled submission and not power. Work on catching that you might be projecting rage, or you might be projecting needing to rescue people. That's that kind of projection replication stuff that I mentioned. Are you able to catch that about this type of father? And lastly, the healing goal with the crazy maker is recognize that you've become the parent and lost out on a childhood and becoming someone's daughter and becoming a person. See the chaos for what it is. The fixed immaturity is not potential. And lastly, stop projecting or try to catch it, that lack of competence onto others or safety onto others. Maybe let people fail or see where they are actually capable and functioning. Having a crazy maker father tends to really trigger people that no one's competent and no one's reliable. That kind of stuff. How to work on these dynamics. If therapy is available to you, or if you resonate with these, or if you're working on your own, if you click right up here and subscribe to a list, you'll get an email with specific journal prompts related to this video on how to work on it. I did it that way so that this video wouldn't be so long in reading these journal prompts, but they're going to be related to your inner child, projection and replication, and how to catch this stuff and how to think about this stuff and look at patterns. So some good news is here is what is actually possible, whether you're in therapy or outside of therapy, just working on your own. One is that you can actually step out of the toxic chase or reactivity dynamics with men or the masculine in general. If you can figure out that inner child piece and the unfinished business with your own father, you can be able to step out of this stuff and catch it. Next is you can actually trust yourself and identify toxic behaviors and patterns and the legacy that your father kind of like left, that you were left holding this bag of just stuff. The more you focus on your father, you can spot these things more, as well as how you project and that projection and replication. Once we truly see how bad it was and how our father impacted us, that will lead to setting more firm boundaries and communicating your needs, letting things go. Our inner adult can really step in, but only if we see what's really going on. And what comes first is seeing how bad it truly was as your father's daughter. And the third kind of piece of good news is that we can learn to prioritize our own emotional well-being. A general rule of thumb is that if our inner child is going to keep trying with or reacting to difficult people, but like with the toxic father, it doesn't go anywhere and you had nothing to work with. So that inner child needs an inner adult to step in and protect them from continuously trying with our actual fathers or chasing partners or chasing the wrong ones or reacting to them. And that is the blueprint and something I'll talk about in a minute called the trauma bias as well. So some final thoughts and some loose ends to kind of get these out of the way. These are patterns that I've seen in my practice of childhood trauma. Some will feel pretty accurate to you. Others won't. I can't realistically name all the nuanced situations Some of these may feel generalized to you or overly simplistic or maybe even too specific to you. And I hope you're able to eventually find someone safe who can hear your story with your father and be seen in that way. We all need that safe person to process our fathers. Another loose end is there are many fathers like these types of fathers, and there are many fathers who are not like these at all. There are fathers refusing to look at their trauma. There are fathers putting everything they have into raising healthy daughters. Don't just look for the toxic fathers. You'll get stuck in your own trauma. Another loose end, and this needs to be named, is that women are shifting, and they're voicing more dissatisfaction about their relationships with men, about equality, about hetero roles. That's an important present piece going on. It's not just a past piece to be explained through toxic fathers. Hopefully that is clear. Another loose end is, yes, some parents actually do get stuck with an abusive partner, like the tragic codependent, and they just can't leave. That is a reality, but one of the problems is, could that parent have at least been real with you about the future? That's another process. Another loose end is,
at my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low, because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that we are all enjoying our wonderful lectures that we are having this amazing Friday evening. And we are learning about ourselves, about others, where our things come from, eh? Why do we feel the way we feel, and how we can conquer and win through the trials and the tribulations. So,
and this is intimate here. As a man, I might have triggered you in this video. Explore if I've actually triggered you about being too casual about these big issues, or seemed insensitive about something, or thoughtless about the topic in some way to you that might feel really big. In this video, did it feel like I didn't understand things like toxic masculinity, or that I was potentially mansplaining to you? That's what I mean about projection or replication. Who might I have taken you back to if I did trigger you, maybe to your own father? What are some things that I actually got right in the video? How might I be different? That is the reason to explore the projection kind of issues. Or I could have sucked too. So could have been that. So another thing to name is that projection is tricky. Your partner can be like your father, or they can be the opposite. Projection is about what our inner child puts onto another person that actually belongs to the abusive father. Or another version of it is that we can give up all of our power to someone when we are projecting that they have all the power and it's not safe to have some power. It's nuanced. It may sound like it's always your fault if you have any feelings in general. That's not what I'm saying. You might be in an abusive relationship, or you might have been in one. And I'm not saying, oh, you're just projecting. But what if it's not abusive, but you feel like it viscerally is? We are all going to need some outside help to figure that out. Before we close here, here are some final thoughts about healing and processing a toxic father. Projection. It can be true that you are with a partner that is dysfunctional, messy, has their own trauma, or is unsafe, or they're actually maybe good enough. However, while you may need to shift and deal with or make big decisions about your partner or the men in your life, or your partner who isn't a man, The work is going to probably be about the toxic father of origin. You can be in similar relationships with men, but it's different from the past in two ways. This is really important. You have more power now as an adult to shift and change, but you had none as a toxic father's daughter growing up. Anytime we say all men are like that, or all women are like that, or I'm never going to be able to feel comfortable or safe, or I'll always get let down by people like that, that's that projection replication stuff. People can be a-holes, I get that. But when we project, we go right back to feeling powerless, and then we're looking for evidence about how we're not safe. Our inner child is looking to confirm past perpetrators with present people. There are some present perpetrators, but if we're only focused on confirming what isn't safe, we'll actually never find what is safe and find some healing there. All five types of toxic fathers can overlap. We can have a monster and an absent stranger combination. You can have a tragic codependent father who's also a crazy maker. But those overlaps are not really that important. You probably will have some overlap. What is important is about being able to recognize your triggers and the dynamics that still need to be dealt with. I'm trying to say, don't get caught up in like, it's really bad because my dad had all five kind of categories. One other final thought is something called trauma bias that I mentioned. Trauma bias in choosing our partners. Let's just say your father was a tragic codependent and enmeshed, and you were his surrogate spouse. Person you're dating, or a man you're dating, who seems like he doesn't overshare, or maybe he doesn't even share at all, or can assert himself and maintain his own autonomy, might be really attractive to you. But because of our inner child feels, it might feel intolerable to our inner child to be with someone, again, who is somewhat cowardly or tragic or enabling or unprotective. The trauma bias is that we are amping up certain qualities in a potential partner and not recognizing or not seeing, it's like tunnel vision, that the person might actually be dismissive, avoidant in their autonomy or independence. But because of your trauma or your trauma bias, you might construe that independence as healthy when maybe it isn't. We often have a broken radar system due to that trauma bias, and our inner child just does not want to be stuck with a similar type of partner or man again. Another example is being attracted to someone who seems like they really have their stuff together because your father was a really messy crazy maker. But because of that trauma bias, you don't catch that the person who has their stuff together is actually incredibly controlling and rigid, and it's actually not that they're well adjusted. Trauma bias is like our inner child looking for the rescue from dynamics that were horrific to us, but we need help seeing the whole picture that's different than tunnel vision. I know that that was a lot to take in. Thank you very much for staying with me so far. If you want a good place to connect on issues like this, check out my monthly healing community where issues like a toxic parent, how
What a day. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I think that we are digesting, we are healing. If you have any takes on it, you can call in. The number in studio is 083-288-401, and we can talk and we can talk and we can share.
You Saves Combo for just 599 Namibian dollars is so popular that we'd gladly repeat it. Hurry to get yours. 10 kilograms each of Champion Super Maize Meal, Bokomo Fetgo Flour, Nice Rice, and 10 kilos Marathon White or Brown Sugar. All four products for only 599 Namibian dollars. You save. I save. Yes, we all save at You Save.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, we are mostoch here. We are going. And whoop. So let's talk about trauma bonds, eh? Let's talk about trauma bonds and maybe how to break free from trauma bonds and see. Because by this point, we do understand what trauma bonds are, right? So let's see.
It can be eye-opening and it can be your salvation. At some level, getting out of a toxic relationship and the bad feelings that accompany it are a form of survivor guilt. Self-preservation and self-protection are all very nice sounding words, but putting them into practice is a whole other level. So let's talk about trauma bonding, a term that comes up often when we're talking about narcissistic relationships. So let's take a step back and ask the question, have you ever looked at your relationship and thought, if a good friend told me that they were being treated in their relationship the way that I am being treated, I would pray that my friend would run away from their relationship as fast as they can. So that's an interesting conundrum, because you'd say that to your friend. But if that is how you are able to view your relationship, but you still can't get out, even though you would tell anyone else to get out of this kind of a situation, you may very well be what we call trauma bonded.
Goeie nuus, Skimba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Skimba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Skimba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Skimba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
The term trauma bonding pretty much encapsulates the entire narcissistic relational dynamic. And lots of people use this term, so let's make sure we get some clarity on it. Some people have likened this idea of trauma bonding to the proverbial Stockholm syndrome. Now, the Stockholm syndrome refers to this story in which a group of hostages ended up sort of falling in love with their captors. So in essence, they had created an emotional bond in the face of the trauma of being held against their will. Now, frankly, more recent research has debunked the Stockholm syndrome as a thing, but the theme of trauma bonding is mirrored in some of what we see as sort of being the patterns or the top notes of Stockholm syndrome. This idea of creating an emotional bond to somebody who's a perpetrator of harm in your life. Now, trauma bonding is reflected in the classical narcissistic relationship cycle: idealization, devaluation, and discarding. Trauma bonding reflects the very tight bonds that are observed in relationships characterized by unhealthy patterns. And these unhealthy patterns include things like inconsistency, invalidation, devaluation, dehumanization, and chaos. In essence, the bonds are made even more watertight around the traumatic and cruel cycles of the relationship. It's basically like equating abuse and trauma with what someone is labeling as love. Now, as I have talked about not only in this series, but in many other videos, the cycle of the narcissistic relationship, idealize, devalue, discard, hoover, and then start it all over again, is very similar to the cycle of addiction. And in fact, the term trauma bonding was initially coined by someone named Dr. Patrick Carnes, and his work was very much focused on sex and love addiction. But again, it gets at this idea of the addictive cycle of an unhealthy relationship. Now, in a healthy relationship, which someday may end, because healthy relationships do sometimes end, the ties aren't as convoluted and twisted because they are not traumatic bonds. Instead, when you end a relationship that was generally healthy, there may be a sense of nostalgia and even a sense of gratitude for the growth you experienced in the relationship. You don't feel that primitive sense of devastation when a healthy relationship ends, but perhaps you may experience a pang and some grief, real grief, for lost memories and missing somebody. But overall, the overarching theme ultimately is often a sense of gratitude and grace for a part of your story, and you move forward from that intact. Now, a lot of that is also predicated on having a history of secure attachment. Now, trauma bonding is something else entirely. It often happens at a blindingly fast speed, and in that way, because it's so quick, it becomes easy to create the dysfunctional cycles of your past. Many people, when they are entering into a trauma-bonded relationship, they'll describe it as intense and amazing and passionate and once in a lifetime and overwhelming. But above all else, it's fast, and then one would say it's incredibly intense. And the speed of these trauma-bonded relationships plays upon another key element of the trauma bond. It's the repetition cycle, the repeating we see in the trauma bond. Trauma bonding reflects an attachment style. And attachment styles are set very early in our lives with what are called primary caregivers, which for most people are their parents. Early relationships, parental relationships that were characterized by push, pull, chaos, abuse, intense emotion, rejection, and cycles of idealization and devaluation and discarding can set the tracks for chaos and invalidation. This kind of sort of chaotic early environment can result in what we call anxious and or avoidant attachment styles. And people with those attachment styles can be more vulnerable to trauma bonding cycles as an adult if these attachment styles aren't addressed in intense therapeutic settings. Now, the quickness and the intensity of what are typically trauma bonded relationships are often mistaken as chemistry. And as I've written in books in the past, that thing called chemistry is actually familiarity. It's a new person's alternating idealization and devaluation reminds us of this early relationship we have with these primary caregivers. It's a familiar chaos. It's so familiar that it evokes something almost primal in us. And we mistake that dysfunctional early memory for chemistry. It's like a developmental deja vu. I've been here before. And the mistake we make is to call it chemistry and romanticize it. Now, children in trauma-bonded relationships learn to do one thing very, very well. They learn to justify their parents' abusive behavior, to keep secrets, to blame themselves, and to idealize their parents, to protect their parents. Children can't get their heads around the idea that a caregiver is harmful, because it really kind of leaves this big gaping hole. If a caregiver is harmful, then what? Who is going to take care of them? Kids don't get to have a plan B. And so their sweet, beautiful little brains sadly have to learn to justify, rationalize, and appease abusive parents. That cycle can then potentially play out in the trauma-bonded adult relationship with the person even thinking about it. It is that familiar that, in fact, to do it differently really would require some thinking. So these relationships are quick, they're intense, they feel like chemistry, they might even feel like magic. And the trauma bond, as a result, slowly gets thicker and thicker. Now, I'm going to use this to take a strange little sideline here and talk about slot machines, okay? If you've ever played a slot machine, you're going to understand this. But slot machines can actually help you understand trauma bonding. Narcissistic relationships work because they are like slot machines. You know, slot machines where you put the coin in and you pull the handle, and if you're lucky, you win an award or you win lots of money. Slot machines work on something called intermittent reinforcement. It's a very fancy way of saying that you don't know when a reward is coming, and you don't know how big the reward will be. You know sometimes that reward can be humongous. More often than not, you don't get anything. This kind of cycle, reward cycle, is the most difficult to unstick a person from. And anybody who's ever played a slot machine knows that. You play the machine, you hold out thinking, maybe I'm going to win on the next pull, and maybe I'm going to win on the next pull. A healthy relationship is actually like a boring slot machine. Like, imagine a slot machine where, like, every third pull you get a dollar. You put a $2 in, you get a dollar back. You put a dollar in, you get a dollar back. It would actually not be very interesting or exciting. It would be reassuring, and it would be healthy, but it sure as heck wouldn't be addictive. Now, regular slot machines, the ones you see in the casinos, they just take our money. Now, sometimes they pay out just a little bit, and that's enough to keep us in the game. Sometimes they pay out a bit more. So instead of paying out, you put in a quarter and you get $5. And that really keeps us in the game. And one day, and we might see it happen to other people, they may pay out a ton. But most of us will never experience that. But we keep sticking around and keep money in to see if it happens. Because after all, it happened to someone else. Look, there's our picture. It happened to that guy. But more often than not, we put money in the slot machine and nothing happens, but we keep sticking it out because we think we're going to get the prize, the jackpot, the reward. That inconsistent reward is a key element of the trauma bond. The rewards and the occasional payouts a person gets in these relationships become the rationalization for the entire relationship. But we had so much fun that one time we went to Paris and you didn't yell at me for that whole day. And that one trip to Paris, that one little jackpot, becomes a rationalization for thousands of days of verbal abuse and invalidation. A rationalization for all of the cash you put into that slot machine. The trauma bond means that for a person, chaos equals love. The old traumatic themes of a childhood, for example, your initial definition of love, which may very well have been chaotic, are played out again. And once again, just like the child, you label it as love. Because this adult chaotic relationship is so reminiscent of the child trauma bond, you make the same rationalizations and the same justifications as you did for your parents. She really does love me. He didn't really mean that. She had a tough childhood. He kind of does take good care of me. In fact, a big part of the trauma bond is something that I term the backstory problem. Trauma-bonded people make excuses for their abuser. They make excuses for their abusive behavior around, for example, their tough childhood, or maybe a childhood where they were impoverished, or understanding that maybe your partner wants to prove himself to his dad, or you'll say things like, oh, he talks without thinking, he doesn't really mean it. The trauma-bonded person is very good at one thing, and that's gaslighting themselves. So, where do you see this link between narcissists and trauma bonds? Part of it relates to that anxious and avoidant attachment cycle that characterizes the entire addictive relationship cycle. Narcissists often are able to draw partners in with intensity, charm, charisma, and it often goes quick. The love bombing can be exciting sexual experiences, exciting travel, exciting concerts, lots of things that have nothing to do with intimacy. By definition, narcissistic relationships always require lots of justifications because without you making lots of rationalizations for this relationship, there's often no healthy reason to stay. You have to come up with those reasons because just as when you were a child, you couldn't step away. Now, trauma bonding can leave a person feeling like they're irrational, saying things to themselves or to the world like, I know this relationship is awful and unhealthy, but I miss her, or I still love him, or I would take him back, or I can't imagine living without her. Even
While a person will acknowledge that their relationship was unhealthy or even abusive, this cycle of trauma bonding is why narcissistic relationships are so difficult to climb out of. So, what are you supposed to do? Because obviously, lots of people leave narcissistic relationships. I see it happen quite regularly in the work I do. And I know it's not easy. It's much more difficult, believe it or not, to leave a narcissistic relationship than it is to leave a healthy relationship, which almost seems paradoxical, but it is. So the question becomes, where do you begin? First, to leave one of these trauma-bonded relationships, you have to acknowledge that what is happening is abuse. I have to say that when my clients tell me their narcissistic relationship stories from the very beginning, and the trauma bonding becomes very apparent to me as they tell me about their relationship, oftentimes the first time I make a comment that the behaviors that they're reporting in their relationship are actually quite abusive, they get quite surprised at my use of that word, abusive. It's a framework that they never even acknowledged. They never even thought that that would be the word that would be used to describe their relationship. But that's often the first step. It's that willingness to acknowledge that these cycles and that their narcissistic partner or family member or whoever this person is in their life, that this behavior is abusive. The second thing is you have to do the deeper dive into your own early attachments. And this does almost always require the guidance of therapy. You have to really look and see, can you see the parallel between the cycles that are playing out for you now and that trauma-bonded cycle from your own childhood? And as an adult, part of the fantasy is that you might be able to master, to like grown up and power through that trauma-bonded relationship that you couldn't do as a child. You know, the third thing you need to keep in mind is you have to recognize that this is not a slot machine. In fact, there is no jackpot here. This particular slot machine called your narcissistic relationship is just going to keep taking your money. And in this case, in the case of a relationship, it's not just your money, it's your energy. It's your authenticity. It's your soul. It's your heart. The narcissist is really not likely to change significantly enough to make a difference. And simply understanding that will break you out and can break you out of the blindness of the trauma-bonded cycle. The fourth thing is to judge the relationship in the here and now. And that means you got to jump on the mindfulness train. You've got to look at their lies now. Their cheating now. Their invalidation now. And stop yourself from making these justifications and rationalizations. When you do that, these cycles look a lot less like love and a lot more like abuse and a lot less like a project where you're going to rescue someone. The fifth thing is to make a list of the things that make you uncomfortable about the relationship and keep adding to it. In your weaker moments, when you feel like you're going to get sucked back in or hoovered back in, look at that list. It becomes a list of the abuse you have suffered. And it may help you sever some of that bond when you can look at it with more clear eyes. The sixth thing is you got to get therapy if you're going through a trauma-bonded cycle. This work is best done with a guide and someone who understands both narcissism and trauma. Trauma bonding is very, very much to me synonymous with the cycle of the narcissistic relationship. Now, are there trauma-bonded cycles that don't include narcissism? Absolutely, it's a wider term. But the fact is, trauma bonding blinds you, it confuses you, and it plays upon your vulnerabilities. You need to pay attention to those early, heady, and very quick days in a relationship. Intense and fast relationships are often danger signals that distract you from the abuse that inevitably lurks ahead. The chaos and the sporadic sort of rewards make these relationships a very dangerous sort of casino to play in. Slot machines tend to be a sucker bet, and very, very few people win the jackpot. But in this case, this isn't just about some coins you're throwing in a machine. This is about your heart and soul, and you want to make sure you don't gamble your heart and soul away. Trauma bonding is real, and it is painful. But if you can have the opportunity to do the psychological work, these bonds can be broken. It's my hope that this video has illuminated some of the themes of trauma bonding for you. It's a term that is often used when we're talking about narcissistic relationships, and by understanding it, you may also understand how in many cases, narcissistic relationship cycles are often lifelong cycles.
And I'm going to lay out 8 common patterns we observe in trauma-bonded relationships. The term trauma-bonded is often used to describe a key dynamic in the narcissistic relationship. It reflects a pattern whereby a person remains bonded or remains in an unhealthy relationship characterized by manipulation, invalidation, and emotional or other forms of abuse. Early experiences of neglectful, chaotic, inconsistent, and in some cases, frankly, abusive relationships impact attachment and relational expectations and result in an equating of love and abuse, or a relationship being a place where a person is always having to work to maintain a partner's interest. While the trauma bond most consistently plays out in adult intimate relationships, it can also be reproduced in close friendships and relationships in the workplace. The language of trauma bonding is a little tricky. If used correctly, it is never meant to blame a survivor who is in one of these relationships, but rather to lay out the unconscious dynamics that may not have been adequately addressed in trauma-focused therapy, so a person can identify these patterns and become aware of the pathological dynamics inherent in the relationship. These are very difficult cycles to break, and it definitely takes time. In this video, I want to lay out 8 core dynamics we observe in trauma-bonded relationships. It can be useful to understand these so you are aware of what may be happening in your relationship. So pattern 1 is justification. Justification is the signature move of trauma-bonded and, in fact, all narcissistic relationships. The litany of they don't mean it, that my partner is stressed, my parent had a tough childhood, it's not their fault, blah, blah, blah. Justification in the trauma-bonded relationship is reflexive. You don't even think about it. It's a manifestation of the cognitive dissonance, a way to break that inconsistent thinking. I want this relationship to last. This person is being cruel to me. So you break that uncomfortable dissonance by saying, I know they're being mean to me, but they're stressed and they didn't mean it. And then you get to keep the relationship. Now, justification starts in childhood. The child attempting to justify the narcissistic or abusive parent's behavior or words. And this is how it becomes an almost reflexive pattern in adult relationships. And not only keeps people stuck in narcissistic and trauma-bonded relationships, but enables others. Number 2 is believing the future faking. Future faking is a key element of narcissistic relationships. Future faking is those many promises that are made in toxic relationships. Promises that are made about getting married, having children, where you're going to live. Sure, I'm going to support you when you go back to school. One day when I retire, we can do this and that. And it is also seen when things start getting unhealthy in a relationship, and you may even start making moves to leave the relationship. And then your partner says, I'm going to go get therapy. I'm going to work on myself. And it never does really happen, at least not in a substantial way. and then you stay longer. People in trauma-bonded relationships want to believe. And as a result, even a little future fakey throwaway statements become a branch to hang on to and to pin those justifications on. People in trauma-bonded relationships may even share the future fakes with friends. My partner said that we are finally going to move so I can pursue my career closer to the city next year. The move will never come, and the trauma-bonded person lives in the hope, but never in the reality. Number three trauma-bonded pattern is you keep having the same fight over and over again. There is sort of what we call a repetition compulsion to the trauma-bonded relationship. The same fight over and over again happens with no resolution because the narcissistic or toxic partner has no intention of changing. It may be about money, about not spending enough time together, about a past indiscretion or lapse in trust, about your respective families, and it never ends. The same fight every holiday season. This is indicative of the lack of empathy or growth on the side of the unhealthy partner and the trauma-bonded partner caught in a cycle of hope and addressing the same issues and having the same argument but hoping for a new outcome. A major piece that gets missed in the trauma-bonded relationship is that toxic personalities are really rigid and do not change. So in the absence of that recognition, the same cycle keeps repeating. Number four, you have mystical, magical thinking about the trauma-bonded partner. People may even point out to the trauma-bonded person how unhealthy the patterns are in the relationship. And many people in trauma-bonded relationships will not be able to give clear and healthy reasons for staying in the relationship, but rather will say things like, "I don't know. It's just something about my person. No one gets it, but it's just something. Something." This vague referencing is a form of magical justification that keeps a person stuck. It's something nobody can understand, right? So it's magic. When giving reasons for commitment, we look for hard and heavy stuff. Respect, kindness, compassion, mutuality, reciprocity, empathy, and growth. A person in a healthy relationship will be able to clearly articulate these clear reasons and not say it's just something. Number five pattern is fear of leaving. A major theme in the trauma-bonded relationship is that even as a person gets closer to recognizing that this is not a healthy relationship and maybe I want to consider stepping away, a fear overcomes a person. The classical fear of most narcissistic relationships, self-doubt about what if I'm wrong? After so many years of making justifications and second-guessing and being confused, that confusion can drive a fear of leaving and going into the unknown. Trauma-bonded and toxic relationships are almost a form of indoctrination, like we would see in a cult. And the way a cult keeps people around is by generating fear of what is out there in the great unknown. Number six pattern is becoming a one-stop shop for your partner. In trauma-bonded relationships, we see the trauma-bonded person attempting to become a one-stop shop for the toxic or narcissistic partner or family member. Not only their partner, but that you sort of become a personal assistant who keeps everything running. You try to be their friend, their shrink, a parental figure who soothes them, their chef, their housekeeper, their cheerleader. You try to look the way they want and be what they want, which is exhausting because what they want at any given time can shift on the daily. And when they are not interested in you, they do not want to be bothered. So you just never know whether to be on or not. This zeal to be all things to the difficult person can overtake a person in a trauma-bonded relationship with the belief that if I do enough for them, they will be happy. Newsflash, they will never be happy. Not because you're lacking anything, but because they're not capable. Number 7 pattern is hiding your feelings and needs. This may be one of the most painful patterns of the trauma-bonded relationship, that you do not feel that you can share your feelings, your needs, your vulnerabilities. And you know what? It is actually true. You can't share those things, at least not without getting hurt. But the pattern of hiding needs and feelings in a trauma-bonded relationship is not about a survival strategy. It often reflects a self-devaluation and a fear of upsetting the narcissistic or toxic person. Again, back to that proverbial walking on eggshells. So holding back needs and feelings is a way of keeping the illusion of the relationship alive. Yes, you are right. Strategically, if you do decide to stay, you do not get to share your feelings because it is not worth the strife and disrespect. But that is from an informed place. And you can intentionally cultivate new and healthy supports. In a trauma-bonded relationship, hiding your feelings and needs is a way to keep the relationship afloat, and a devaluation of self after a lifetime of relationships in which your feelings were not valued. Number 8 is rationalizing the relationship to other people or hiding the patterns from others. In trauma-bonded relationships, people often do not share what is really happening in the relationship with other people around them. People who are trauma-bonded are aware that what is happening in their relationship is not a good look. But for all the reasons I have listed here, people in these relationships are caught in a cycle of defending it to themselves. So, obviously, that defending it to themselves is going to extend to the world at large, much like a child who's growing up in a very emotionally abusive or chaotic or invalidating home, who talks about their childhood in glowing or happy terms. The shame of being from an unhappy family is overwhelming. A trauma-bonded person may describe the relationship as good, may talk about the future faked stuff as though it is really happening, may hide the uncomfortable stuff, or be very vague when speaking about the relationship. What is so difficult about this is that it means that many trauma-bonded people do not get the support they need, since they are sort of offering up a rosy picture of their life, and in this way, they may not be hearing the dissenting voices, meaning that the patterns of justification sustain and the person in this relationship remains more stuck. Even in therapy, and I have worked with lots of trauma-bonded people in therapy, initially they will talk and share about the relationship and will back it up with, and that what's happening in my relationship, that's normal, right? This is just the daily stress of a relationship, right? And my job is to give them the gentle, no, it's not. As many of you hear about the trauma-bonded cycle, you may recognize that these are cycles we see in traditionally abusive relationships, such as those observed in domestic violence, in childhoods characterized by abuse and neglect, in abusive workplace situations. And these cycles are observed in all of those and in any relationship characterized by trauma bonding. You may be wondering, is this permanent? Can it change? Yeah, it can. And it is very effortful. In fact, trauma bonding is likely why when a person meets a partner who is stable and kind and compassionate and no drama, and will say, gosh darn it, this person is so nice and this whole relationship is so healthy, but I don't know, I don't think we have a connection. In the absence of the chaos and the frantic trying to get the partner to notice and jump through hoops, It's a place that nobody recognizes at home. It's not dysfunctional enough. It takes a while to let go of those worn patterns of childhood and break out of the cycles of drama equals love, abuse equals love, invalidation equals love. Trauma bonding can change, and it can and it does happen. And it requires you to understand the architecture of these relationships and of yourself. There is so much shame activated by these relationship cycles and then subsequent self-blame. This isn't your fault. It's the not understanding it or not getting it. And sometimes, once you get it, you can start changing these patterns. I hope this gives you some clarity on the trauma-bonded patterns that you might be reading this and saying, ah, is that what the trauma bond is? I hope it gives you that clarity. And if you want to add anything to these 8 patterns, please do so. And just throw that in the comments so we can all benefit. Thank you.
And I wonder how many of you ask yourself this question. Why do I feel like I'm the bad person in my narcissistic relationship? Have any of you ever asked yourself that question? Like, I feel like I'm the bad one. If you do, drop it in the comments. It'd be interesting to see how many of you watching and saying, yes, I feel like I'm the bad one. We're going to break that down. Before we get to that, gentle reminder, go to those video notes. If you do feel like you're the bad person, you do need some healing. Come join us in this healing program and hit that link. And also,
great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just $36 a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Flame. But why is it in narcissistic relationships that people, despite being narcissistically abused, that so many people feel like they are the bad person in these relationships? So at this point, on this channel, on this YouTube channel, we have talked about trauma bonding ad nauseum, what it is, the different things that sort of describe trauma bonding. But mostly we talk about how trauma bonding keeps us stuck in these relationships or drawn to narcissistic relationships in the first place. What about after you decide to do something about your narcissistic relationship? Maybe you decide to end your relationship, or maybe you decide to go no contact with someone, or you massively gray rock or firewall, or not only disconnect from the narcissist, but all of the enablers. You do that. Then you look at the narcissistic person and they actually kind of seem sad to see you go, or they seem kind of lost without you, or they kind of slump about in a victimized way. Now, they may still also do and say manipulative, gaslighting, mean things when you're around them. But once you decide to do what you do, to step away maybe, you can see that they're impacted by it, even if they don't say it. And it's at that point when they're like, oh, this person's a little hurt. Nearly every survivor of narcissistic abuse I have ever talked to or worked with will say, ugh, I feel like I'm the bad person. I feel like I'm a bad person because I'm not talking to them anymore, or I'm not engaging, or I'm setting these boundaries with my parent or my ex or my adult child or my friend or my sibling. I feel like I'm mean. I feel like I've become so dark-hearted. And then it starts to slip pretty quickly from there, and people start thinking, maybe I'm a monster. Maybe I'm the narcissist. Pushing back on narcissistic abuse is no joke. It sounds so easy in words. Oh, don't defend, don't engage, don't explain, gray rock, don't respond, walk away. Intellectually, we can all acknowledge that those are all choices, and probably good ones in a narcissistic relationship. But when you make those choices, you feel sick. Many people literally report feeling sick to their stomachs, losing their appetite, getting headaches, just because they're setting consistent boundaries, or when they finally say enough is enough and don't engage. You know the dance. You all do. You know that if you stay in this relationship, nothing's ever going to change.
And many people do stay just so they don't have to feel sick and don't have to feel like the bad person, to not have to feel like that mean person. Actually doing it, actually setting the boundary, actually not engaging, actually seeing that when you pull away, in more than a few cases, the narcissistic person may look lost or sad or pathetic. They may actually look like they miss you, or they tell you how much you ruined their lives, or they go really heavy on all the self-victimized stuff. It's a terrible feeling. It's as though every trauma-bonded cell in your body orients toward not wanting to be the one that feels like the bad one, the mean one, the cold one. And you may even feel that perhaps this relationship is sort of your penance or your bad luck, and you stick it out so you don't have to feel like a bad person. If you really want to hear a sick twist on this one, I was raised in a very traditional Hindu South Asian family, where I have had contact with many, many people who are in terrible marriages or terrible family situations say, I am being punished from my behavior in a past life. I must owe this person, and they're talking about the abuser, something. So I'm telling you now, I know about some deep trauma-bonded cultural religious stuff that can twist a person's mind. So many survivors of narcissistic abuse are at risk for feeling that it's easier to take the role of enduring the narcissist's BS and maltreatment than it is to walk away and manage not only the discomfort of feeling like the cruel one, but also manage all the criticisms you'll get from people outside of you, outside of the relationship. Now, there's no easy answer here. It's a process. You do have to pay attention to how you feel. Now, when the narcissist is cut out of your life and they're not around, you're going to feel better in many ways, less stressed, more content, maybe even happy. Over time, you may feel more brave, courageous, and the less and less contact you have with the narcissist, maybe even less plagued by self-doubt. While some narcissists don't care if you leave, many do. And remember that abandonment and related issues are a part of narcissism. So they may actually not do well when you go. And there will be times you will be ruminating on that icky, awful feeling of having done something to someone that does not feel good to you. The more empathic you are, the more this way of thinking is going to bring you down. Sadly, this is where your empathy, a wonderful part of you, is actually kind of keeping you stuck. Your empathy makes you vulnerable to falling back into it as well, because you don't want to feel like a bad person, because you're not. This is the legacy of narcissistic abuse I actually hate the most. The idea that stepping away and setting boundaries and saving yourself, that you have to carry along with that, this burden, that you're not a nice person. And sadly, the prevailing wisdom in the world is that the people who put up and shut up are somehow, maybe they're not so mean, right? Because it means that at some level, survivors of narcissistic abuse cannot win. They either have to be abused in the relationship or live with this sense that you did something bad. Well, here's the good news. Over time, that idea that you are bad, it'll slowly fade. Narcissistic abuse changes us in permanent ways. It means that we cannot live like little children in a fantasy world anymore. That we recognize that life is a series of really hard choices that are often unpopular, especially if we are trying to attempt to protect ourselves. And there's no magical moment when a fairy god person comes down and waves a wand and makes the trauma bonds go away or gives us a happy ending after our trauma bonds. Nope. Survivors of narcissistic abuse learn that to set boundaries and disengage is uncomfortable and unpopular. And with time, we recognize that no, we are not bad people, but that we did have to save ourselves. And yet that felt really uncomfortable. Many of you know that I believe that a major part of healing is journaling and record keeping. A powerful method of doing that, pessimistic and awful as it feels, is to write down all of the bad things that happened in the relationship. I want you to keep all of the abusive text messages and emails. When those trauma-bonded feelings come up, when you feel guilty or bad or mean, please read all of that. When you feel that you are being mean or bad or misreading the situation, going back and seeing all that stuff you wrote down that was sent to you, it can be eye-opening and it can be your salvation. At some level, getting out of a toxic relationship and the bad feelings that accompany it are a form of survivor guilt. Self-preservation and self-protection are all very nice-sounding words, but putting them into practice is a whole other level. And it's a whole nother experience for people who are trauma bonded. You always feel like you're trying to swim against some kind of psychological current or riptide. So no, I'm here to tell you, you are not a bad person for setting boundaries and disengaging and creating distance from someone who harmed you and will continue to harm you. You made a choice to take care of yourself. The narcissistic person is making a choice too. To abuse people, including you. They have the freedom to make another choice. They just aren't. Their bad choice, though, cannot remain your prison. Hope that makes sense, but that thinking I'm the bad person for these things I'm doing in this relationship, like distancing myself and seeing the victimization on their face, you are not a bad person. That is a classic manipulation, and I want to break you out of that. I understand it's uncomfortable, but all growth is uncomfortable. Trauma bonds can feel like super glue. They feel impossible to get unstuck. Trauma bonds represent lifelong lessons, lessons that are not good for you. Things like love equals rejection, love equals shame and humiliation, or that love means having to win someone over or please them or reassure them. Trauma bonds mean having the same fights over and over again, justifying the bad behavior and the red flags, pushing down your own feelings and not sharing them, isolation and shame. Sometimes, as some people will put it, feeling a magical, unnameable connection that you keep coming back to despite how bad it is for you. The trauma bond is a catch-22 of sorts. When you are in the relationship, it feels terrible a lot of the time, with experiences like invalidation, gaslighting, rage, manipulation, dismissiveness, contempt. When the relationship ends or goes away, maybe you break it off, maybe they break it off, you feel this terrible sense of emptiness. You can't breathe. You ruminate. You feel like you made a mistake. You feel anxious. You're damned if you do. You're damned if you don't. So here is a little trick. A little bit of mindful awareness that you can use or you can do while you are in a narcissistic relationship. Because I know, I'm aware that many people watching these videos are still very much stuck in a wide range of narcissistic relationships and still not sure what to do. So bear with me. So next time that you are away from your narcissistic person, maybe it's a few hours during the workday, maybe it's for several days if they have to travel for work or something, maybe for a half a day or a whole day if they go out to do something. At such a time, you don't have the narcissist with you. I want you to do something. I want you to pay attention to how you feel. Like, I want you to really pay attention. Journal, talk about it, do what you need to do, but really pay attention. When they are not there, narcissist isn't around, how do you feel? I can't be the one to answer that question for you, but I'm going to spitball a little here. That for a significant majority of you, the answers may be things like, I feel more relaxed. Or in some cases, you may sleep better. I mean, I know for a few of you, if the narcissist isn't around, you may ruminate about stuff like infidelity. That's a separate issue. Most of you may sleep better. You may feel more like yourself when they're not around. You may breathe more deeply. You may laugh more. You may do things that you want, eat things you want, engage in activities you want. You may enjoy the quiet. You may feel like you are in a better rhythm. You may find yourself to be more in sync with children, with pets, with other people that interact with your household. You may feel a little less eggshelly. You may not feel like you have to be careful about what you do or say, or feel like you have to move around the house in a tense and fearful way. All of this gets tricky. It's an important exercise. The trauma bond often means that people will say, yes, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the time away. But part of that was because I knew they were coming back. If I thought they were never coming back, it may not be so great. But this isn't just the idea that, I can fall asleep reading, which I can't do when my partner's home, or I can eat cereal for dinner and not deal with the dishes. I really want you to think about how you feel when this person is not in your space or is not in your house. If you feel better as a person, more relaxed, more authentic, more you, pay attention to that. Many people fall into the justification that, everyone likes a break from their partner from time to time. Yeah, sure. But this is more than that. If you feel like you are a better you when they are away, that's an important piece of information. If you feel like it's easier for you to get through the world when they're not there, that's an important piece of information. And as a part of this thought experiment, I want you to close your eyes and imagine what life would be like if this you felt like this every day. How would that feel? How would your life be different? How would you live differently? I would love to hear from you, and if you could, drop your answers in the comments below if you feel comfortable. I have worked over the years with many, many people who had narcissistic parents while they were growing up. And without exception, they would share about how they felt on those wonderful and miraculous days and weeks, if they were lucky, months, when the narcissistic parent was away. They would often see their other parent relax a bit more. The eggshells got swept away for a few days. The entire household would be less tense. It would feel like a holiday just because that parent was on a business trip or whatever. The household just felt less intense. Everyone was happier. The parent would come home, and the tension and the dark cloud were back. The child may not have known what narcissism was, but they started getting a fuller picture of what the presence of that parent meant and how good it felt when they weren't around. Now, thinking about when the narcissistic person in your life as an adult is away, for the small group of you who said, no, when the narcissistic person in my life is away, I feel so much worse. I know that it is awful and abusive when they are around, but I have a lot of trouble being alone, and being around a rager is still better than being alone. But I gotta tell you, then the issues around trauma bonds and relational dynamics is deeper than what I am talking about here. And in such a case, therapy would be absolutely essential to explore that, because those are going to be deeper things to disentangle. For many people who are in narcissistic relationships, the confusion, the cognitive dissonance, the trauma bondedness, the fear, the hope can pull a person away from really paying attention to how they feel when the narcissistic person is not around. People are so accustomed to fighting in and fighting for these relationships that they forget how good it feels when they are alone and they can finally exhale. Vulnerability to hoovering is highest in the weeks and months after a relationship obviously ends, which is why, at that time, all of the time needs to go into those lists I always want people to make. All of the bad things that happened in the relationship, for example. So you can be reminded of how bad it really was, and then pay attention to how good it really is that you aren't on edge and can finally sweep the damned eggshells out of your house. I remember once, a long time ago, talking to a woman who had been married for a really, really long time to a very narcissistic man in a very traditional marriage. She liked the idea of being married. She liked being a mother. She liked keeping a gracious home. She acknowledged that there was something about the traditional role that really worked for her. And it was really an offset to some of the chaos of her own childhood. Her husband, however, was a major malcontent and abusive, raging, cheap, awful person. Nothing was joyful or fun with him. After their children were grown and out of the house, she caught him in about the 7th extramarital affair he had had, and finally she felt it was just too humiliating to stay in it. Kids were out of the house. The divorce was incredibly messy, incredibly expensive, and he pulled every narcissistic trick in the book. After about a year, she decided to take her first solo vacation. She had not traveled alone for a very, very long time. As she made her way through the airport alone, she had talked about how sad and how lonely she felt, especially seeing other people traveling in groups. When we talked about her focusing instead on what it would feel like if the nasty, irritable, monstrous, narcissistic husband had been there with her, she smiled and she said, "You know, if I had thought about it that way in the airport, it wouldn't have felt so lonely. In fact, it would have felt really good to move to the airport at my pace and browse in the windows and get the snack I wanted." So after a trauma-bonded relationship, it is easy to get caught in the idea of romanticizing the idea of togetherness or the relationship. But if you really close your eyes and think about how really pleasant it is when they are not around, it can go a long way to cutting away at those trauma bonds. The problem is people focus so much on their loneliness, they don't stop to think about how good it feels when the narcissists aren't around. As always, thanks again for tuning in. Please give the video a thumbs up if you found it useful. The feedback definitely helps me know what people want to hear about or don't.
Ritavazende kize imba izwezi pili. Luekerize mikwaye mwiencha kukona kunolofaza kwa nkufisa hamo chwalo ni mata amsikavu na kare. Kana mwitukiserize kubona msevelezo wa imba ye, mufumane lisevelezo zezwezi pili ze kakulifafela mashiringi alika na $36 million kakweli. Kapa kamikwaye kutesifa fasi ye tatama, 5% machipisa hamungo lisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa hamungo lisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa hamungo lisari kwerize lishumi peri. Muketeri kwerize Movata, Kumukone, Kalaki, Kola Zendezo, Imba, Miswalezi, Kamachipisa, Imba, Toku, Ganifasi, Kaufela. We pay for Severezoza, Imba Kachenu, Kumukone, Kola Zende, Kaufela.
Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys are still out there. I hope you guys are listening to the lectures. I hope that you guys are mellowing into everything because we're talking about traumatic relationships, like relationships trauma. We're talking about what happens when you guys traumatize one another or the other is traumatizing you or you are traumatizing somebody else. Now, we had spoken about relationship trauma and we had said that relationship trauma is a psychological distress caused by harmful experiences within an intimate relationship such as emotional, physical, sexual abuse and infidelity, betrayal or neglect. It can lead to long-lasting effects like difficulties with trust, intimacy, and communication, and may manifest as symptoms like anxiety, flashbacks, irritability, and sleep problems. And the causes or the types are abuse. Physical, verbal, emotional, sexual abuse within an intimate relationship. Those are the causes of relationship trauma. Then we have betrayal, significant breach of trust, such as infidelity or dishonesty. And then we have neglect, the lack of essential support, validation, caregiving within a relationship. That's neglect. And toxic dynamics, experiences in toxic or narcissistic relationships that involve manipulation or emotional drainage. Childhood experiences. Trauma can also stem from early experiences with parents or guardians, as we all know. And now, symptoms and effects. Emotional. Anxiety, panic attacks, sadness, anger, feelings of unsafety, and fear of future abuse. Those are the symptoms, right, of emotional, of relationship trauma. You might feel anxious, you might panic, you might have panic attacks, you might be sad, you might be angry, and you might also have emotional outbursts. And when we talk about the psyche or cognitive, we can speak about difficulty concentrating, in intrusive memories. You know, you can be cooking and then you just get a memory just that comes in. Oh, that other day when this person almost stabbed me with this knife, you understand? Or flashbacks, or even irritability, where you are just irritated, right? But it comes from your experiences. And then we have behavioral, which is nightmares. Hey, nightmares. There. I'm number one there. Nightmares. Imagine having a dream or a nightmare that you are reliving a specific thing, you know, and it ends differently. And you wake up, and sometimes you have sleep problems and avoidance of situations that trigger reminders of the trauma. Like, for example, driving fast. Yeah. Driving fast. And then it triggers the day that maybe you were in a car accident, and then it just doesn't end well for you. So you just avoid driving fast. That's why you find those aunties on the freeway driving extremely slow, and you're like, oh, marakuko taipenyano. And you're like, eee, kanti. It's because of her experiences. And then relationships based. Difficulties with trust, intimacy, and communication in future relationships. And this is the cause of every single ounce of trauma that you have endured in that relationship. So ladies and gentlemen, we're talking.
The reason people don't leave toxic relationships is because they aren't toxic all the time. And especially in the case of a trauma bond, there's a cycle of intermittent positive reinforcement that tricks our brain to endure the bad because of the occasional good. One day you're being yelled at or given the silent treatment, and then the next they're telling you how amazing you are and how they can't imagine life without you. And the reason those cycles of extreme highs followed by extreme lows is so dangerous is because it rewires our brain to stay waiting for the next hit of dopamine. And the question is, why would anyone stay in a relationship like that? We stay because we hope that one day the pain will go away and things will go back to the way they were. We stay because we think maybe if we work hard enough, maybe if we change something, they would treat us better. We stay because even though they're breaking us, it feels like they're the only one that can put us back together and make us feel whole. We stay because we love them, but we're trapped in a cycle of mistreatment followed by sporadic love bombing that repeats itself enough that our brain actually starts to find safety and predictability, even in the chaos or abuse. So today I want to talk a little bit about how we get stuck in trauma-bonded relationships and, more importantly, how to detach from them. So first, what is a trauma bond? A trauma bond is an intense psychological and emotional attachment to a cycle where someone mistreats you through neglect or cruelty or emotional withdrawal or all of the above, but then randomly switches and is affectionate and kind and maybe even apologetic. They can go from demeaning you and belittling you and calling you names and screaming at you to just a few days later pretending like nothing ever happened and love bombing you with praise and admiration and gifts and attention. And if I can be honest with you, I hate to use the word addicted here because it's such a strong word, but I began to feel addicted to someone that I knew was mistreating me. I couldn't imagine my life without them, and that's a dangerous thought. The idea of leaving scared me, but the idea of them leaving me sent me into a panic. So I did anything I could to avoid that, which meant abandoning myself in order to not be abandoned. I wasn't just afraid of being left. I was afraid of what that would mean if I was left. It would have meant that I would have given everything that I had to this person, and it wasn't enough. Which must mean that I'm not enough, right? And that's the fear. I'll never be enough. No one's ever going to love me if they know the real me. But healing means detaching from that story that you're not good enough. And healing requires us to stop internalizing their negativity towards us. They're projecting their own insecurities onto us. It's time that we realize that their bad behavior and their toxicity has nothing to do with you. And the problem with a trauma bond is you start to equate the highs and lows with actual intimacy, but it's not. You start to see them treating you right as reconciliation and repair for their bad behavior, and it's not. They never actually took accountability for the ways that they treated you. They just tried to sweep it under the rug. They never asked you how their actions impacted you. That's not repairing anything. And you're trying to forgive them and move on, but that's one of the reasons that you're feeling even more numb and disconnected and hopeless in this relationship. Because intensity isn't the same thing as intimacy, and chaos doesn't lead to connection. And it feels like you've been through war together, right? You've survived so much together. You feel so bonded. But the truth is, they caused the war. They built the roller coaster that's giving you emotional whiplash. It's not something you're going through together. They caused it. And a big part of this video is condemning how they're treating you. What they're doing is wrong, and you never deserve to be called names or mistreated or chronically disrespected. Someone has to call them out on how they manipulate and gaslight and how every conversation turns into a fight and even your vulnerability is somehow taken as an attack. And the other part of this video is reminding you that even though they built the roller coaster, at a certain point we have to take accountability for the fact that we're still choosing to ride it. Just because you feel bonded doesn't mean that you're in a safe relationship. Just because you feel connected doesn't mean that they aren't actively betraying you. Just because you feel close to this person doesn't mean that they are actually building trust and intimacy with you. And healing actually occurs when we stop asking, "Do I feel bonded?" and ask, "Is this person actually safe? And if not, what's keeping me in this unsafe relationship?" And please don't mishear me. I'm not talking about a standard of perfection. I'm not saying that we shouldn't give our partners grace. I'm not saying we shouldn't forgive each other. What I'm talking about is a pattern of someone who says they love you, but you do not feel safe around this person because of their hurtful actions that they refuse to change. So step one of breaking a trauma bond is awareness. Let's just be honest with ourselves. If something bothered you, if you were hurt by something they said or did, could you bring it up to them in a respectfully vulnerable way and be met with empathy and comfort and curiosity? Or would you be dismissed? Would they take it as an attack? Would they get defensive? Would they escalate and blame you? Because it's easy to make excuses for them. We give them the benefit of the doubt. We rationalize. But the truth is, you know that behavior is unacceptable. You know your vulnerability doesn't deserve to be punished, because you would never do that to them, would you? You would never be allowed to talk to them the way that they talk to you. You would never be able to treat them the way that they treat you and not be punished for it, right? And why do you think that is? It's because they think they are entitled. They don't see a problem with their behavior. They don't see a problem with the way that they speak to you. And I'm just here to compassionately remind you, that's not love. Because real love is kind and gentle and considerate. Love is all about mutual respect and equality. We're both equal in value and importance in this relationship. That means I don't speak to you in a way that I would not like to be spoken to. Love never calls names or screams at or hits or belittles or devalues or dismisses. That's not love. Now, do we all mess up? Do we say something in the heat of the moment that we regret? Absolutely we do. But love takes accountability. Love repairs. That's the difference. Love cares about how my words and actions impacted you, right? Because if I love you, then I'm going to put my ego and pride to the side for the benefit of this relationship and you. And one of the biggest problems with trauma-bonded relationships is that so many people have no idea what love even is, because healthy, safe love wasn't modeled for you. And we would be fooling ourselves if we truly think that our past doesn't play a role in our present relationships. Because you learned things as a child. You learned whether it was safe to express feelings. You learned whether you need to earn love and affection. You learned whether or not you should actually ever trust someone with your heart. You learned that love was chaotic and unpredictable, that that's normal. normal. Or maybe that was where you first learned that you need to abandon your own needs and desires to feel connected to another person, right? I need to pay close attention to their mood so I can predict the next outburst. And maybe that's exactly where your over-functioning started. I need to suppress. I need to stay silent. I need to sacrifice myself or do the work of two people to feel safe in a relationship. And my guess is, if you're in this type of relationship, you went through some stuff as a child. And you might downplay it, you might dismiss it, it wasn't that bad. But that doesn't change the fact that somewhere along the way, your body felt unsafe. And now you're coping through people-pleasing and anxious attachment and giving all of yourself to someone who seems to only take. And the sad reality is trauma-bonded relationships need certain traits from their partners in order to function. I'm not victim-blaming. I'm not saying you ever deserve to be in this relationship. I'm saying what helped me on my healing journey was realizing that narcissistic and abusive people need certain character traits from their partner, or else the relationship wouldn't work. They need someone who puts someone else's needs, wants, and desires above their own. They need someone who is scared to set boundaries because of the conflict or disconnection that it could cause. They need someone who gives second chances and forgives because they believe the best about people. They need someone who is susceptible to shame and low self-esteem. Someone who finds it difficult to advocate for their needs because it feels selfish. Someone who questions themselves. Maybe I'm the problem here. But just remember, you're the only one ever asking that question, aren't you? They've never thought, how am I the problem here? These relationships need one partner who is willing to apologize first, because you're willing to take accountability for your side. You're more than happy to empathize with their perspective, aren't you? In fact, you think, if I could just find the right words, maybe they would understand me or stop yelling at me. You have to be loyal and submissive and accommodating, or else this relationship would simply fall apart, because the only thing holding it together is you doing the work of two people, you abandoning yourself, you over-functioning, because that's what's felt normal for you your whole life. And you want to know the saddest part about all this? You could have told me all that, and I would have agreed with you 100%, but I still wouldn't have left. Because the problem isn't learning more information. The problem is attachment. We feel deeply bonded to this person. We're addicted to the idea that this person is our source of safety and security. We're convinced that we can love them into changing, or that we can endure hardships because that's just what love does, right? We can't imagine our life without them. And one of the reasons that happens is subconsciously our brain is connecting this bond with the attachment that we had with our parents all those years ago. And when you were a kid who wasn't self-sufficient, what would it mean for that attachment to be broken? It could be catastrophic. You could die. And even though you know intellectually you wouldn't die if they left, or if you left them, your nervous system doesn't seem to care, because that's how it feels when this attachment is threatened in any way. But in reality, we're not moving towards healing. We're recreating the dysfunctional attachments from our past. We're keeping those wounds open by staying and not learning how to detach from them. It's going to cost us. I had to learn that lesson the hard way. I had to feel the pain of abandonment. I had to feel the pain of getting cheated on. I had to feel the pain of being neglected and dismissed by someone who claimed they loved me, because the pain of staying has to become greater than the pain of leaving for you to finally face your fears and detach from a bond that's actually destroying you. And the last thing that I would ever want is for you to experience pain. But if it's that pain that leads to your healing and learning that you deserve so much more than the bare minimum, if it's that pain that leads to your self-worth being reignited in your soul and you find the courage to finally show up authentically and talk about your boundaries and needs, if that's the pain that helps you realize that abandonment isn't as scary as you thought it would be, because you're still here for you. And once we go through that, we realize we felt far more alone in the toxic relationship than we do single. If that's the pain we're talking about, then it's worth it. So if we want to break out of the trauma bond, we have to detach from the fantasy and ground ourselves in reality. You're hopeful of who they could become if they weren't so angry or stressed or busy, but that fantasy is keeping you stuck. You need to acknowledge where you are right now. I don't care about who they could be. I don't care about their potential. Who have they shown themselves to consistently be for you right now? Are they a safe place for you? Are they consistently kind and considerate? Can they hold space for you to be honest and vulnerable when something they did unintentionally hurts you? Are they a source of peace or chaos in your life? And these are the questions I get all the time. Well, do they know? Is the narcissistic person aware? It doesn't matter if they know. What matters is it keeps happening even though you've asked them to stop. We keep ourselves stuck by saying, well, maybe they don't know, instead of remembering they aren't interested in knowing, right? They don't care about self-reflection. They aren't interested in changing their behavior. They know that because they've told you numerous times. So stop getting hung up on questions where it requires you to put in more work to fix something that they don't see as broken. Because you deserve someone who is just as concerned with hearing you and understanding your pain as you are with finding the perfect words so they don't feel attacked. Stop getting stuck in doing their work for them. Are they a narcissist? Are they avoidant attachment? Or are they just a jerk? Does this meet criteria for abuse? It doesn't matter, because whatever the answer is, what's next? It still ends with you trying to convince someone else to treat you better and them inevitably dismissing or invalidating you. You need to detach from the illusion that this is love, right? It's intense, it's chaotic, it's an emotional roller coaster. That doesn't mean it's love, because love doesn't keep you in fight or flight. Love doesn't belittle or refuse to take accountability. Love doesn't chronically invalidate someone else's experience. If this was love, you wouldn't feel so confused all the time. The reason you're confused is because your brain knows something that your heart won't admit, that this isn't safe or sustainable. But what if they treat the next person better? I don't care. They didn't treat you right. Right? They broke trust over and over again in this relationship. Healing happens when you stop being jealous about the next person and you're actually sad for the next person, because the odds are they aren't going to magically become more emotionally mature or committed or learn how to love. The odds are they are going to continue hurting someone. Breaking a trauma bond requires us to detach from our own shame, because it's easy for you to think that you're the problem here. Because ever since childhood, you've been really good at looking inward to try to figure out how you've contributed to this situation somehow, right? How might you be at fault? But do you know why we do that? Because there's power in that. I mean, just think about it. If you caused this, then you can change it. But they are using your guilt and shame to manipulate you, right? I mean, if you think that somehow you caused them to mistreat you, then they can keep not taking accountability, they can play the victim, and they can just blame you. And that's just going to keep you stuck. No matter how much you blame yourself, it's not going to fix their anger problem, is it? No matter how much you self-reflect, it doesn't lead to them actually considering your perspective. Because once again, they don't see anything wrong with their behavior. So I'm asking you, detach from the false narrative in your head that you are not good enough. And I realize that we can't heal all that in one video, but just for a moment, let me be a competing voice in your mind. You're not broken. You're not damaged. You're lovable. And I know you're not perfect. You have flaws just like the rest of us. But you deserve to be loved and cared for and prioritized. You deserve someone who feels lucky to be with you. And there's a part of you where it's really hard to hear those things because you're not sure if they're true. But they are. And sometimes our shame keeps us stuck because we're embarrassed for how much we've already put up with. So we stop talking to our friends and family about what we're going through because we're tired of complaining about it. We're embarrassed to describe how terrible it is again, and it makes us feel terrible for continuing to put up with it. So we begin to hate ourselves. But that hatred and shame just keeps us stuck. And I need you to start separating from that. You didn't do anything wrong. You're not a bad person. Anyone can get trapped in a trauma bond, especially people who have endured some trauma growing up. You can't break this through hate. The only way to break it is love. And love means treating ourselves the way that we treat other people. And how would you feel if you found out your best friend or your children were in a relationship where their partner was treating them the way that your partner treats you? It would break your heart, wouldn't it? That needs to wake us up. And whatever you would say to them is exactly what you need to tell yourself. You would say, you didn't do anything wrong, but you know this person doesn't bring out the best in you. You know that you're in pain. You know that their behavior is unacceptable, and they refuse to change. And I know it's really hard to leave. I know that you love and care about them. But I'm happy to help you find a way out, if you'll let me. It's time to detach from the idea that boundaries and talking about what we need to feel safe and loved leads to disconnection. Healthy boundaries don't cause relationships to fall apart. The people that punish you for setting healthy boundaries are the same people who benefited from you not having any. And if you're anything like me, you didn't set boundaries because it felt hurtful, it felt selfish, it felt scary. But the truth is you deserve someone who actually wants to know your boundaries. Because all boundaries are is just putting words and limits to what actually feels good for you in a relationship. Just ask yourself the question, would you want your partner to actually be honest about what feels good for them in a relationship? Of course you would, because you care about their limits, you care about their needs, you care about what helps them feel valued and respected and honored in this relationship, right? You want them to feel loved. You want to know what would it take for that to happen. You deserve the same thing. Now, this is extremely important. If you feel like you're in an abusive situation, the solution isn't to set boundaries with unsafe people. The boundary is you removing yourself from unsafe environments. And yeah, I know that's extremely difficult, but the number one priority is your safety. And sometimes the safest thing you can do is go no contact. We have to detach from the idea that we would be abandoning them if we left. And I get it, you never want them to feel abandoned. Because once again, you're treating them exactly the way that you want to be treated. You want to save them from that pain. But what you need to realize is they have already abandoned you in large and small ways in this relationship through their actions. They have no interest in getting help. They have no interest in healing or empathy or mutual respect. They have no interest in getting clean or sober. They have no interest in reciprocating the effort and energy that you're putting into this relationship. Until you finally say that you're done. And then the story changes. Now they'll do anything. Now they're begging you. They're telling you that you're abandoning them, that you're leaving without even trying. But you and I both know that part of the reason you're so frustrated and exhausted and burnt out is because all you've done is try to make this work the whole time. Now, whether you give them another chance is up to you. But healing starts when you face your fear of leaving this relationship or face your fear of them leaving, when you know this relationship isn't healthy or safe long term. Healing happens when you set a standard for how you know you deserve to be treated. Not perfectly, just consistently, right? Healing starts when you start advocating for your needs again and understand that regardless of whether you stay with them or not, that old relationship, that old dynamic has to end. And we can choose to build a new relationship together with a foundation of actual trust and intimacy and safety, or I have to step away. But whatever happens, you have to start working on that foundation in yourself today. Detachment happens when you realize that their bad behavior had nothing to do with you. They had a choice just like everyone else does on how they want to treat other people.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think that this gentleman is spitting truths. He's spitting truths. But ladies and gentlemen, I'm bidding you guys farewell. I love you guys forever and a day, and I'll see you tomorrow for us to conclude after our lectures. I hope you guys have taken notes, and I hope you guys have really heard everything that was said here tonight so that we can discuss it tomorrow at 1 p.m. Good night.
They made their choices over and over again, and what they didn't realize is that actions have consequences. And every time we call someone names or we dismiss them or neglect them, it comes at a cost. And the truth is, they are simply too immature to realize that they are just reaping the distance and disconnection that they sowed for a long time. But you need to detach from your role as savior, because I know you. You're an empath. You're a giver. You wanted to heal them. You wanted to help them. You wanted to rescue them from their pain. But they didn't want to be rescued, did they? They wanted to take whatever you were willing to give, use it up, and spit it back out. People that truly want to heal don't make it someone else's job. They take full ownership and they do the work. Don't let someone tell you that they want another chance, but they have no interest in learning about doing the work to heal their own self-centeredness and pride and control issues. Healing comes when we detach from the belief that we needed to sacrifice our own needs and boundaries in order to be loved, right? That we needed to abandon ourselves in order to be accepted, because that's not true. Or if it was true with them, it's not supposed to be that way. I had to realize the harsh truth. I was mad at them for not treating me right. I was angry at them for not respecting my boundaries, for not considering me, for not prioritizing me. But I wasn't prioritizing me. I wasn't advocating for me. I wasn't respecting my own boundaries. And healing started when I realized that's my job to do first. I need to stop outsourcing those jobs to someone else and do them myself. But Jimmy, why aren't you picking on them, right? They're the problem. They're neglectful. They're toxic. Why aren't you getting onto them? Because I can't control them. And there's like a 1% chance that they have any interest in watching any of my videos to learn how to repair from the damage that their self-centeredness and emotional abuse has caused. That's why I have to focus on you. Detaching from a trauma bond isn't only about leaving them. It's about finding you again, coming back to you. You don't remember who you are. You've spent so much time serving and sacrificing for others, you don't even know what feels good in a relationship to you. The truth is, you've looked to them to validate your own worth and value for a long time. You've looked to this relationship to feel needed and important, right? But healing begins when we start to find that safety and security in ourselves first. Healing comes when we realize, maybe I don't need to talk more. Maybe they don't have an interest in understanding me. Why am I writing this long paragraph to try to convince them that what they did was wrong? They've already told me they don't care. Why am I giving them another opportunity to twist my words and become the victim? They aren't interested or capable in having a good faith discussion where anyone's perspective is taken into account except their own. And I don't care how toxic this relationship was. For some of you, when you detach, even though you knew this relationship wasn't healthy, even if you know everything that I just talked about, when you finally go no contact or break it off for good, you're still going to experience a lot of grief and loss and loneliness. And it's completely normal to think about them all the time. It's normal to miss them a lot. You're going to dream about them. You're going to cry over them. You're going to start to wonder, maybe you've made a mistake, right? You're going to remember all the good times, and you're going to forget a lot of the bad times. Was it really that bad? Did I try everything? I mean, maybe it would be different if we did X, Y, and Z in the future. I just need you to know that's completely normal. Let yourself grieve. Let yourself feel all of those feelings. Acknowledge the fear. Acknowledge the sadness. And acknowledge how confusing it is to miss someone who you know mistreated you. Feel it all. Accept it all. But hold firm to the plan. The plan is, we know they weren't right for us. Maybe they aren't a bad person. Doesn't really matter. They weren't your person. You gave them enough chances. I promise you, you did. You gave it 100%. You know that. It's in these moments when we're most vulnerable to remember the moments when they laughed when you cried or told you to stop being so dramatic. Remember all those moments you were left alone in your pain, where you knew it wasn't safe to share a hurt or feeling or need because it would just start another fight. I'm not saying only remember those moments. You can remember the good times too. But don't you dare forget that those good times were always followed up by some really bad ones. And you know that love isn't supposed to wreck your nervous system like that. You shouldn't live in a constant state of fear or anxiety. Yes, love is a sacrifice, and no matter who you're with, it's going to come with some hardships, but love should never feel like a constant battlefield. Love should calm you, not confuse you. Love would never want your partner walking on eggshells to feel safe around you. And it's in these moments that it's vital that we talk to a good therapist or coach that can help us breathe through and sit in these uncomfortable moments filled with pain and regret and hopelessness. And they can help us to move through and navigate these. Because like I said before, it often feels like we're breaking an addiction, doesn't it? And there's a reason that addictions are really hard to break. They can help you with that. The truth is, we have to starve this addiction. And the way we stop is by realizing that addictions are escapes. We were using this bond to cover up our pain and fear, and it's time that we face it. And sitting in that discomfort requires us to learn a new skill of emotional regulation and positive self-talk and reminding ourselves that this pain is worth it. It doesn't mean we did anything wrong. It's a normal part of grief. We're going to use this pain and see it as an opportunity for growth and healing and finding safety and security in ourselves and other safe people. The way we make this pain worse is by staying in contact with them and using them as a source of safety and starting this whole painful process over again. Remind yourself that you are working towards a new vision for your life. You're headed in a new direction. Keep taking those steps, and the more that you put one foot in front of the other, headed in a direction where you know you want to end up with peace and safety and healthy connection. And of course, there's going to be times where you want to look back, but you'll be farther and farther away from that old life and those old cycles. And when you turn around, it will inspire you to keep moving forward. Missing them doesn't mean you made the wrong choice, right? It just means that your body misses the love and connection that you hoped you would get in that relationship. But now you know that relationships require a heck of a lot more than someone just saying they love you. They need safety and intimacy and connection. And you know that wasn't possible in that relationship. And if you're anything like me, we want them to reach out and tell us how sorry they are and how they made such a big mistake taking us for granted and they would never do that again. And if they could just get us back, they'd make everything right. But there comes a time when you have to detach from that hope and just move in a different direction, even if your brain feels like you're making a wrong decision. Allow yourself to possibly be wrong and still make a firm decision. I've chosen to end this relationship for good. And when your brain says, yeah, but what if it could have been better? Respond with, you might be right, and I still made my choice. I'm not going back. And yes, it's true. It's going to be hard for a little while. But scroll through the comments, because it gets better. And on the other side of this is a version of you that you haven't seen in a long time. Someone who loves themselves and feels good about themselves and knows what they deserve in a relationship. I'm proud of you for taking these steps. I'm praying for you and pulling for you. Thank you so much for taking the time to watch this today. Can't wait to see you in the next one.
Oh, wow. What a wonderful, wonderful way to end the night. From me, the matriarch, I bid you farewell with my friends.